This is Steve Maxner beginning the interview with David Haas on the 21st of March 2001 at approximately 3:15 p.m. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Haas is in Mickleton, New Jersey. Sir, why don't you go ahead and begin by telling us when and where you were born, where you grew up.
Okay, I was born in the city of Philadelphia on October 21st in 1952, and I grew up in, basically in the city. Some more stuff would be my father married a girl from Detroit, Michigan, and he met her during World War II, and they ended up having 10 children.
Wow.
I was right in the middle there. I was number five.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in, second grade, my parents were separated. My mom went back to Detroit, and my dad raised all the kids by himself. He had a little bit of help from a great aunt, a great uncle that would come over and watch us. And, of course, I attended high school in Philadelphia, but at age 17, I dropped out of school and then enlisted into the military.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what was it about school? Did you like it or dislike it? Or?
Well, I guess basically with school was probably, it's probably a result of the type of work I do now. Is that I've always been a person that didn't care to be indoors.
Mm-hmm.
So when a lot of times in school, I was staring out the window instead of paying attention to the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened? The other thing that happened was my father, when I was in high school, he remarried. He got married rather, and married a girl from New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And at age 16, he was moving over to New Jersey, and I told him at age 16 in Philadelphia, you could drive, but you had to be 17 over in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that, I wouldn't be able to drive, and I had already worked and got enough money to put a car together, purchase a car. So I made arrangements to live with my sister in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that time in Pennsylvania, you didn't have auto insurance, and I got involved in an automobile accident.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman, I plowed into the back of her, and the woman was, the wife of a doctor, and she was saying her neck was sore and stuff like that. And so I got kind of scared not having any insurance, so I decided maybe I ought to go join the service and get out of town and try and run from my problems, I guess I was thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to my dad. And I said, look, I've seen a recruiter, but because I'm only 17, I need a parent's signature. And he had said no, that he wanted me to finish school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I looked my mother up, and she signed for me, so I went into service. And when I got into service, I contacted the woman that I had the automobile accident with, and she was a little upset that I had joined the service and said that, hey, there was no problem with the neck, but, she wanted the money to have the car repaired, so I set up an allotment and paid off the damage to the car.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically why I ended up dropping out of school, joining the service.
Oh. Did any of your other siblings enter the service?
Yeah, at the time, my oldest brother was in the Air Force,
mm-hmm.
and then... just as I got out of the service, the next youngest brother joined the Army, and he was in the military.
Okay. And your older brother, did he go to Vietnam or serve in theater?
Yes, he served in Vietnam. He went to he was at Tan Son Nhut Air Base.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I first got my orders to go to Vietnam, I was only 17 years old. And my brother was over there, so
mm-hmm.
I had contacted my CO then and told him, hey, well, you really can't send me over there because I got a brother there, plus I'm only 17. So they cut me orders for Fort Hood, Texas. Mm-hmm. And I stayed there until my 18th birthday. And they gave me orders for Vietnam.
Now, did you have a very close relationship with your older brother in the Air Force? At the time?
At the time, yes, I did. And in fact, he was always someone that I looked up to. He was, you know, he was, I would say, 6 years older, and he was always, you know, when growing up in the city, he was the big brother that would watch over you. If anybody would give you any trouble, you go tell him, and he'd go talk to the person that's giving you trouble and straighten it out. You know? So yeah.
And did he write home much about his experiences in Vietnam before you decided to enlist?
No, actually, he didn't write home that much because at the time he went into service and he got married, so I guess most of his writing was to his wife, and he had a child at home, so.
Okay.
So no, he didn't speak too much about his experience. In fact, from the point that he went into service. Till this day, I really don't get to see him that much because he, when he ended up retiring from the military, he was in Alabama, and that's where he's living now. So
okay.
I really don't get to see him too much.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said your father was in World War II.
That's correct.
Did he talk much about his military or wartime experiences with you?
Well,
as you were growing up?
He kind of... he was pretty elusive about what he did, you know. I would always ask him questions like, you know, what did you do? And he would say that he carried this big rock with him all the time. And whenever anything happened, he would hide behind this big rock, he would tell me. So, no, he really didn't really speak about his experience too much in the military.
Mm-hmm.
But he was like a pay clerk. And what he ended up doing was he was over in India, and that dude was there, and they used to, he told me he'd fly around in like a Piper Cub and go out to the field and on payday and pay everybody. You know. So that was basically his job.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about uncles or other friends of the family that had military experience either in the Second World War or Korea or maybe even the First World War? That talked to you at all about their experience, or?
Well, I had an uncle that was at in the Korean War, and he talked a little bit about it. He was at Pork Chop Hill, the hill where they made that movie about. So you know, he talked a little bit about it. He said that the Chinese would just come in at you in waves, or the Koreans, I guess, mixed with Chinese, but he didn't really. He really didn't indicate that it was a bad experience or anything.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, when you were making your decision to enlist, how much about the Vietnam War did you, understand or know about?
Well, I really, as I look back on it today, I was pretty naive as to what all was going on over in the Vietnam War. I knew that, you would see the press release, on the news at night. There was a guy that I knew that joined the Marines that went over there and came back, and he really didn't talk too much about it, although, he told some boastful war stories about, that he said basically all we were trying to do is get body counts and stuff like that, but he didn't really kind of get into the detail, like why we were there or what was the purpose or anything. You know?
And did you understand when he said all they were trying to do was get body count?
No. He was basically, he said that they used to keep marks on their helmets for each time they would get a confirmed kill, and basically, I understood that, that what the theory was behind it, that every time you would get a confirmed kill, they'd put an X on their helmet liner.
Mm-hmm.
So, I basically understood that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And let's see, when you entered the service, it was 1969. When was it?
Actually, I went in January of 1970.
Yeah, okay, it was January 70.
Yeah.
By that time, President Nixon had come into office, was talking about shifting the war to Vietnamization. Were you aware of any of these political activities, just domestically in terms of news? Did you keep up with news at all, or anything like that?
I vaguely kept up with it. I knew more so when I got to Vietnam. There was more talk then about downsizing the U.S. involvement and turning it over to the Vietnamese. But no, I didn't at the time. No, I figured when I went in the military, I knew Vietnam was a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I thought it was a pretty strong possibility. Mm-hmm. And growing up at the time that I did, with all the John Wayne movies and things like that, and with the family background, it basically was, that was the thing to do,
mm-hmm.
To serve your country.
Mm-hmm. Did you mentioned John Wayne movies? Had you seen Green Berets?
Yes, I believe I did see it,
mm-hmm.
But I don't know that it made more of an impact than probably some of the some of the other war movies or some of the TV series that was on. Like there was a show called Combat,
mm-hmm.
and I think it had Vic Morrow in it or something like that. It was just, that probably had more of an impact on me as mm-hmm. to like the deal about going to a Soviet country.
Mm-hmm. And did you think that those TV programs or movies misrepresented or, looking back on how those movies influenced you, what do you think now?
Well, I definitely feel that they were they weren't quite the real thing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess they were more dramatized than my actual experience over in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like in my particular case, anyhow, it seemed like if you watched Combat or one of those movies, they were seemed like they were almost constantly in battle and for a prolonged period of times, where my experience seemed like it was more you could go weeks or months at a time with not even seeing the elusive North Vietnamese, and then when there actually was a situation where it was getting shot at or something,
mm-hmm.
it happened so fast and then it was over almost as fast, at least with my experience, where
mm-hmm.
the movie almost portrayed it like it was something that was ongoing over and up, nonstop almost.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And, let's see. So when you enlisted, were you all that concerned about going to Vietnam?
No, I kind of figured I probably would be going,
mm-hmm.
and I would think that back at that time, I guess that young age, you almost feel like you're invincible. It could happen to somebody else, but it's not going to happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I really wasn't that concerned about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what was basic training like for you?
Basic training was, I thought it was a pretty good experience myself.
Mm-hmm.
I took basic training at Fort Bragg, North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
and I was with an outfit that was, the training company was EA2, and I guess after I got done with basic training, I believe that probably I was in the best shape of my life. I don't think I was ever in such good physical shape. They really job was that, I thought. And it was kind of, you know, everything I had heard before going down there, basic training is going to be the worst thing you've ever experienced in life. And it pretty much it was tough, but I think it was overall. I think it's something that I think the Army had to do to get you in shape, and then also, you know, I think it played a part of getting you. They actually kind of like I would say they mentally break you down so that when somebody tells you to do something, you do it without thinking. I think that was, you know, part of the training. And then they gave you basically an overall good idea about the military. You know, they covered military justice. They covered a little bit of all the different ranks and things of that nature. You know, gave you an opportunity to qualify with some weapons. And I guess... Plus, they gave you all the shots that you needed to go overseas. Mm-hmm. And it was a pretty good experience, I think.
Okay. What was the most challenging part for you?
I would say, let's see, the most challenging part. I guess the physical fitness, I guess, was probably the most challenging because it was very strenuous, and I'm the type of person that if you do challenge me, I'm going to take on that challenge and try and do the best that I can do. So I found that to be an interesting challenge. And by the time basic training was done, I scored pretty high in what they call the PT test, mm-hmm. you know, and I was in my platoon. I ran I believe it was the 1 mile race that you had to run with the pack and everything. On I finished first in my platoon. In fact, the drill sergeant used to get on me because I was a cigarette smoker, you know, and he said, "Oh, you wait till the mile test. Wait till the mile test. We'll see how good you are," you know. You want to smoke, you'll finish last in the platoon. Well, that just, you know, that was a challenge to me, so mm-hmm. I was going to prove them wrong. I was going to finish first, so that's what I did. You know? Mm-hmm. So, and it was funny how, and he probably knew that. He probably, you know, because he could see that I was in pretty good shape, and, you know, and that was his way of getting the most out of me. You know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Did anybody have any serious problems while they were going through basic training in your platoon?
Well, we had, it was kind of like it was a mixture of a lot of different people. You had, they had what they call RA, which was regular Army. They were the people that enlist. That was, of course, I was part of that group. And then there was US. They were the people that were drafted. And then they had the NGs, which were the National Guard. And, of course, they kind of teased them and called them Nixon's girls. You know, for the acronym, and then you had some of the drafted personnel. Like there was one gentleman, I believe he was from Ohio. He was kind of tall and heavy set, and very much out of shape. But he was also very brainy, and they wanted him to go to West Point. That's, I guess, he must have had a real high aptitude test score, plus I guess his high school records, and I don't know, maybe he even had some college before he got drafted, but they wanted him to go to West Point, and he kept on refusing to even consider it, and they kind of like tried to put more pressure on him, you know, well, you're going to be in the infantry, so you're going to have to run harder, so you have to do more push-ups. They were trying to break him down, so he would, you know, eventually say, okay, send me to West Point, and then there was, you know, some of the other drafted guys. There was one case where I was on fire watch one night. Fire watch was they would have somebody awake in the barracks at all times, so in case something would catch fire, they could wake everybody else up. And I guess it was probably more trying to train you about guard duty. And, you know, you would stay on a one-hour shift, and then you would wake up the next guy. And there was a guy named Tony. I can't remember his last name, but he was up on the second bunk. And I was sitting at the top of the stairs, and all of a sudden I hear him fall out of bed. And he hit the floor, and he didn't move, so I walked down there, and I tried to see if he was okay. And I shook him. I'm like, Tony, you all right? You all right? And all of a sudden he just stood up and started running full speed and went nonstop right into this wall, hit a wall, and hit, dropped to the floor. So I picked him up, threw him on my shoulder, and carried him down to the night guard and called the CQ in the orderly room, and they took him away in an ambulance. And everybody was saying that he's probably trying to get out of the service, saying, you know, that he's a sleepwalker or something like that. They'll cut him loose. Well, a couple weeks later, I saw him marching in a company that was 2 weeks behind us. So, that, you know, I guess he was in the hospital for a little bit, and then they just put him in another company. So I guess they were some of the problems. I'm trying to think. Oh, one of the other things that happened was at the time, the Army had a regulations that you were allowed to grow a mustache. Mm-hmm. So I think I was in the base exchange or something like that, and they had the regulations on the wall and saying that you're allowed to wear a mustache. Well, our platoon sergeant wanted everybody clean shaved, you know, so I started growing a mustache. So the platoon sergeant, you know, was telling me, hey, you've got to shave that mustache off. And I told him, I said, well, it's in the regulations. You're allowed to have one. So he took me in to see the commanding officer. And the commanding officer, you know, read the regulations. And it was supposed to be like an eighth of an inch up from the top of your lip. And it could be no wider than a quarter of an inch. And it couldn't extend past the corner of your mouth. So I said, okay. Well, every morning he would call me to the front of the formation and look at my mustache and said, oh, it's extending past your corner of your mouth. You run in there and shave it, you know. And it finally got to the point where I said, well, it's no use even having it. And I shaved it off, you know. So that was, you know, some of the little problems, I guess, but nothing major that I can remember.
No one was injured or hurt?
No, just that one kid that ran into the wall, you know, that I can remember. I guess there were some guys that maybe pulled muscles when they were running or something like that, and had to go to the medics and get taken care of for pulled muscles, but no bloodshed or anything that I can remember.
Okay. What weapons training did you receive?
Well, at the time, they actually, in basic training, they qualified us in both the M16 and the M14 rifle. Basically, we concentrated on the, we carried the M16, and we qualified with the M16 first, and then afterwards they had us sight in an M14 and shoot that. And it was kind of funny because with the M14, I qualified as an expert, and with the M16 that I probably fired most of the time, I was a marksman. I don't know if the M14 was more accurate or maybe it was just more comfortable for me.
Mm-hmm. Did you yourself have a personal preference after you fired both weapons?
I thought if I was going to be an infantryman, I would rather carry the M16 around because it was lighter weight than carrying a big the M14, which was, you know, wood stock and everything. It seemed like it was three times heavier. So. That would be the only preference that I would have think of.
Okay. And did they explain to you why they had you qualify with both? I mean, you've got the M16. Why are you also qualifying with the M14?
No, they didn't. They didn't really explain to us at that time. But I guess, you know, I found out later. But I think that happened a couple of years before I even enlisted. That originally they had the. The M16 was having problems, so I guess maybe, you know, it would just be pure speculation on my part. As the Army, I guess, figured, well, you know, if we have any more problems with these M16s, we're going to go back to the M14. I don't know. Or maybe it would be a weapon that might still be in service over in Vietnam, and there's a chance that you would run into it. The other possibility was because would be that we did have some National Guard guys, and I guess maybe when they went back to their outfit, maybe they had an M14, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't know why they had to qualify with both of them.
Okay. And the drill instructors that you had, did they have Vietnam War experience?
Yes. We had a drill sergeant and an assistant, and I believe they both had Vietnam experience.
Did they talk much about it?
Yeah, they basically they would use their Vietnam experience that to kind of say, like, if you were slouching or something like that, well, you know, they said, well, you're the kind of guy that Charlie's going to get.
Mm-hmm.
And if he doesn't get you, if you're slack like that, your own guys will get you, because you don't want, you know, a slack guy in a platoon, because they'll end up getting you killed, you know. So he used that type of, but no, he really didn't even explain where he was or mm-hmm. what his job was over there or anything.
Did they talk about booby traps and stuff like that?
I don't know. They didn't talk about it, but what happened was, when I was getting ready to, when I finally did get my orders to go to Vietnam, they sent me to Fort Lewis, Washington, where mm-hmm. they process you to go over to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and you're there for about a week, and while you're there for a week, they give you RVN training, and then at that site there, they had like a Vietnamese village set up. I mean, it actually looked like a Vietnamese village, and they covered trip players and stuff like that. And then they put, I guess, a collection of whatever MOSs were there, and put them all together and made them like an infantry squad. And you would go into this village, and you'd have to watch out for booby traps. It was all done with blanks. They had guys who were playing VCs dressed up in black pajamas, and they would be, you know, coming out of the jungle at you, or they'd be inside the hooches and pop out a window, start shooting at you, or something like that. So that's where you really got into booby traps. And then when I got over into Vietnam, when I finally got assigned to the 101st Airborne, before you actually you went to your company that you would work for, they had in-country RVN training. And one of the things that they did do was, they took us down to the perimeter, and they said that all of you would be doing night duty, and they said that we have a Chu Hoi North Vietnamese soldier that came over to our side, and the drill instructor's back was at the wire, and the North Vietnamese Chu Hoi, what he did was demonstrating him crawling through the wire, how he was a sapper, how he would sneak through the wire at night, and you could see it actually going on, how he, you know, he could find his way through the wire, and he would actually walked into where he stood right up alongside the instructor, but why he was talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So there was, that was basically, any training that I got about Vietnam was like a week before I got there, and then a week after I got there,
mm-hmm.
actually arrived in country.
Okay. When you finally got out into the field, did you find that limited RVN training that you did receive before and after, that it did help some?
Well, in my case, I don't think it gave me a clue of what was going on,
mm-hmm.
but I was a helicopter crew chief, so one thing that I was exempt from guard duty, so I never had to stand perimeter guard. So,
mm-hmm.
but seeing that sapper come through the wire was it put me on guard, thinking, okay, well, you know, this can happen, you know, and it also put me on guard that, you know, if there was an attack on the base, that, you know, they could be walking around within the base. So, you know, it made me aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as walking into the village and looking for booby traps and stuff like that, it didn't come into play for me because, thank God, I never got shot down where I had to walk through the jungles or into a village. But I guess it gave me a better idea of what type of enemy we were facing.
Mm-hmm. Now, so you went from basic training at Fort Bragg to Fort Rucker, Alabama, for your advanced training, correct?
That's correct.
Why don't you go ahead and talk about your advanced training?
Okay. What had happened was, I guess I could start with, when you enlisted in the service, you had I went in with a guaranteed MOS and of becoming what I thought was a helicopter repairman, or actually an aircraft repairman. When I went to see the recruiter and told him I was interested in it, and he said, well, what would you like to do? I told him, I said, well, I worked at a gas station as an auto mechanic. Maybe I could be an auto mechanic in the Army. So he said, well, we have to send you and give you an aptitude test. So I took an aptitude test, and when he called me back and said, hey, your scores come in, and he said, come on in the office, I'll talk to you. And when I got there, he says, look, he says, you scored so high on the mechanical end, he says that we can make an aircraft mechanic out of you. Well, I thought, oh, that's the greatest thing, you know, because when I get out of the service, maybe I can get a job as an aircraft mechanic. Probably plays good, pays pretty good. But little did I know at the time that the Army was looking for helicopter crew members. You know? So when I went to Fort Rutgers, Alabama, they gave you like an introduction course. It's like a 3-week course, if I remember right, of basic aircraft maintenance. And it covered both rotary wing, which is a helicopter, and fixed wing, which is an airplane, because the Army had both type aircraft. And it gave you just a basic understanding of aircraft, which I thought was pretty good. It kind of covered the theory of flight and, you know, all the four forces acting on an aircraft when it's in flight. Talked about all the different type of engines, some of the different fuels that they use and lubrications, and gave you a general background on aircraft maintenance. And then while you were there, they had you pick out three of, I think they probably had about maybe 10 aircraft that you would be interested in crewing. And two of them were fixed wings, so I picked them as my, wanted to work on. And then the third one was a helicopter. And so I picked the Huey. The Huey to me looked the nicest one, not knowing what the Huey's job was. So then at the end of that 3-week period, they said, okay, well, you qualified for Huey. So then they sent you on to another class, and then I specialized just in the UE helicopter. And they did a pretty good, I thought they did a pretty good overall job of getting you familiar with all the ins and outs of the UE helicopter. They covered everything, you know, the power plant, which would be the engine. They covered the rotor system, both the main rotor, the tail rotor, you know, the transmission. They went into the airframe itself, how it was built, and also they covered the construction of the skin, how that was made, what it was made of. They went into the flight controls, showing you. They actually had, in each different class you went, you had a UE helicopter that was disassembled to the point where you could actually see what they were talking about, and then they would also actually have you do some hands-on where you would work on the different pieces, pull it apart, put it back together. And they covered some of the hydraulic systems. They really didn't cover any of the electronics. They basically told you what they were, and most of those units you could remove them and replace them, but they actually had, within those fields, they had avionics guys that would work on the radio equipment and all the flight instruments and stuff like that. And they did a very decent job. You know, I thought in the 5 weeks' time, they crammed a lot in there. And I found it pretty interesting, and I scored pretty high in all the tests. In fact, I finished in the top of my class there. And because of the fact that in basic training I did so well, I was promoted to E2. The top 10 guys in the platoon became E2. Well, then when I went to advanced individual training, I did well enough there that I was actually never an E3. I got promoted right to an E4, so I didn't really I had no time in rank, and as a TSC, I went right to a Spec 4.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they did a pretty good job. It was they had civilian instructors along with military instructors. The instructors did a pretty good job about keeping you awake. I guess they could, you know, some of them had a system where they could see, like, oh, there's a couple of the eyes that are nodding, you know, let's go outside and run around a little bit. Or there was one civilian instructor I remember that he had, this was probably the power plant system. He had a dry shaft. The dry shaft on a U, he's like a 3-inch round tube. And he would, if you would fall asleep, he would walk over and just hold it about shoulder high and drop it on the floor and make a heck of a noise and wake you up.
Mm-hmm.
So there was all different personalities, which I thought was good too, because each instructor was specialized in their own phase of the training. So it wasn't 5 weeks of the same instructor. You know, it was
mm-hmm.
like a different instructor every day, it seemed like. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And then the only thing that I thought that maybe they lacked in there was they actually didn't cover too much of the actual crewing of a helicopter. What I mean by that is when you're actually as a crew chief, when you're flying on board, there's a communication that you have to have with the pilot and your gunner. And you know, when you're landing in some of those tight LZs, the crew chief and the gunner can see the back of the helicopter. So there's got to be like coordinated talking, so that you know you can tell the pilot, hey, you're getting a little too close to the trees on this side, move to the left. Or, you know, when you're steady talking to them, come on down, the tail rotor's clear, the skids are clear. You know, so they didn't really cover anything like that. And then the radio system on board, the intercom system on board the helicopter, there was some toggle switches where you could listen to probably four or five different radios at one time. You know, you'd have an FM radio, an AM radio, and then the helicopter actually had two FM radios, so that you could be tuned into two different nets. So there was a selector switch for that, and you know, so I kind of, when I went to Vietnam, I didn't know anything about that. And then the other thing that they didn't cover was instrument flight, flying in a cloudy environment. The first time it happened, we were flying in a cloudy environment, I kind of had a little bit of a vertigo, because I didn't realize that the pilot was using instruments to fly. I thought, how could he tell if we're upside down or not? You know, I sure the heck can't tell, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of like, I thought maybe they could have covered a little bit more on crewing,
mm-hmm.
where they did. You know, it was basically a maintenance, it was a maintenance school. Mm-hmm. And then when I did get to Vietnam, I guess my military MOS was a helicopter repairman, and anybody that crewed was on a voluntary basis, you know. Maybe that's why they didn't cover it. I guess maybe they figured maybe only two guys out of the whole class are actually going to be crewmen.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
Now, when they were talking about the physical characteristics of the aircraft, and in particular the skin, at that time, did they talk about the magnesium component and fire hazard, stuff like that?
Yeah, they did cover it. They did say that magnesium was pretty combustible.
Mm-hmm.
But they also covered the fact that the fuel cells were, if bullets should go through the fuel cells, they would seal up, you know, automatic seal up. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So, they did mention that fact,
mm-hmm.
that it was highly combustible.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there anything else that you would wish they had talked about in your training before you got to Vietnam?
I guess the other thing that I thought that maybe they should have covered a little more was firing the helicopter from, or firing a machine gun from the air. It seemed like the training on that was pretty short. If I remember correctly, I went up one time and it was both sides of the helicopter shot. There was a target range and they had, like, it looked like to me like they had sheets strung out down on the ground. And I would say that we were probably up in the air for only a half an hour and both sides of the aircraft had to shoot. So I think... by the time I got my instructions and everything, I may have only fired a machine gun for 5 minutes up in the air, where I thought that maybe they should have, you know, gave you a little more detail on that. And then the other thing that was that they didn't cover at all was like trying to we would carry all different kinds of weapons on board. We had a M78 grenade launcher that we would shoot from the helicopter. We would also carry, there was like a post that was in front of the gunner's seat that you could hang just about anything you wanted on there. So we carried tear gas grenades, smoke grenades, fragment grenades, you know, and they really didn't touch base on that at all in AIT.
How did they treat you differently in AIT versus basic training?
It seemed like to me in AIT you were more on your own than supervised. We had a class. I would say there was probably 12 guys in the class, mm-hmm. And they made one of the guys. The class leader, he was probably the oldest guy in the class, I remember, and they made me the assistant class leader. And it was, they gave us more responsibility. They would tell the class, okay, they gave the class leader the class schedule, and he said, make sure your guys are there, you know, and it was almost like you wake them up in the morning, you get them to the mess hall, you make sure that they're ready to go to class, and we would march ourselves to class, you know,
mm-hmm.
And where that never happened in basic training. You were always, the drill sergeant was forever there. You know, it seemed like the guy never slept or something. You know, where in advanced individual training, it was almost they left you on your own a little more.
Yeah.
And I guess they used the if the class was out of order or something went wrong, you know, the first sergeant would chew out the class leader, and then the class leader would chew out the assistant class leader, and the chain of command, I guess, was used more.
Well, how about in terms of physical, the use of mechanisms for discipline, that is, you know, dropping you for push-ups, or even physical contact between trainees and trainers? How did that differ between basic and AIT?
Well, at the time that I went in the 1970, I think the physical contact within basic training was kind of like almost taboo. You know, I can't remember the drill sergeant hitting anybody or anything of that nature. Like I said, basically in it. AIT, you were almost on your own. As far as any kind of discipline for the, I'm trying to remember what some of I guess the teachers, if you were out of order, definitely they would threaten you with either an Article 15 or they would give you some kind of, go out and to the parade field and run out around the flagpole and back or something like that, you know. But, I would say it was, when you got to AIT, in my particular case, it was these were all people that volunteered to be there. So the attitude was a little bit different than somebody that was drafted. You know what I mean? So I don't think there was really any discipline problems.
Mm-hmm.
That that I can really remember. One thing that did happen to me was when we got a pass one time and went down to Panama City, Florida, which wasn't too far from Fort Rutgers, and spent a weekend down there, and I got sunburned real bad. And one of the things in the military, you know, we were told that if you had a sunburn, that you could get an Article 15, because you know, the instructors said that you're now government property and your body's government property, and if you get sunburned and can't perform, you damage government property. So I had gotten sunburned real bad, and I really had a hard time walking, and but I didn't want to go to medical or anything. So what I did was, there was one big guy in the class that I held on to the back of his belt, and he kind of pulled me to class while I was almost walking stiff-legged or trying to march or whatever. And you know, that it's just, I guess it was basically a different frame of mind amongst the guys that volunteered to go into the military. Mm-hmm. They weren't forced to be there.
Right. Well, how much before and in your, while you were still stateside going through training, how much did you hear about the anti-war movement?
It wasn't really, you know, one thing that I wasn't really much for watching television, so I really didn't hear too much about it, except for the fact that I did have a girlfriend that was going to Penn State at the time, and writing back and forth with her, you know, she had told me about, you know, some of the demonstrations on campus and things of that nature. So I was basically, you know, I was aware of it. It's not like I was oblivious to it, but it didn't seem it was something that, you know, the instructors would talk about. Hey, did you see the news last night? You know, there was a riot here or a riot there, you know. So it wasn't something that was really talked about.
Okay. Was there anything else you wanted to discuss about your training?
Let's see if I can try and think of anything else. I guess that's about that. I think I covered pretty much on the training that I can remember.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and discuss when you received your orders to Vietnam? You know, what were some of the thoughts that went through your head? You realized you're going to war.
Okay. Well, like I said earlier, when I got done advanced individual training. They actually had cut me orders for Vietnam, mm-hmm. and I was able to get out of that because I was only 17 at the time, and my brother was over there. So they sent me to Fort Hood, Texas. Mm-hmm. And when I went to Fort Hood, Texas, they put me with an armored division, and I ended up being a truck mechanic down there, which was kind of ironic because I thought when I was going in, well, that would be a good job, you know. So I was with the 502nd, with the armored division down here in Fort Hood, Texas, and I really didn't care. Sorry, I know you're from Texas, but I didn't really care for that part of Texas. It seemed like we were in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little town named Killeen, Texas,
mm-hmm.
and it seemed like I think the closest town might have been Temple, Texas, if I remember. And it seemed like that took forever to get to. You know, I wasn't accustomed to that growing up in the city. It seemed
mm-hmm.
like everything was readily available to you.
Yeah.
In fact, I could be to the shore in 1 hour's time if I wanted to, and in the mountains of 1 hour time. And
mm-hmm.
Texas was kind of like spread out, and you just drive forever through this flat desert or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went there, there was almost nothing to do, so I enrolled in Central Texas College. I was actually taking a private pilot's course,
mm-hmm.
and just for something to do to keep me occupied in the evenings. And and I wasn't there that long, and my on my birthday, they gave me orders for Vietnam, and the orders were actually dated the day before my birthday, October 20th, and my birthday is October 21st.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody must have marked their calendar, or I don't know, maybe they had a computer database at that time, and my name was spit out as soon as, and my brother had returned from Vietnam.
Okay.
So I received orders. And I guess one of the first things that came to my mind is that at this point I hadn't had any leave. You know, I left home for basic training, and I hadn't returned home. So one of the first things on my mind was, oh, good, I get a chance to go home.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing I was thinking was, well, I don't really like this Texas. So, and plus the fact that I was working on trucks I thought I did quite well in the helicopter maintenance school, and I figured, well, maybe I'll get a chance to work on helicopters now. So I actually looked at it as a positive thing.
Okay.
So
you weren't afraid, concerned?
No, for the most part, you know, being just turning 18,
mm-hmm.
you know, like I said earlier,
yeah.
it's you feel invincible at that point. You know?
Right.
Well, it won't happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. Well, how much leave time did you get before you left?
I got 30 days leave, and I think it was 7 days travel time or something like that.
And what did your folks think? I mean, you went home, you told them, yeah, you got your orders for Vietnam.
They were concerned, I guess, you know, that, you know, but they really didn't, you know, my dad really didn't express it to me. He was trying to be strong, but, you know, I found out years later that, you know, after I come back from Vietnam, my brother told me that when I finally did get on the plane to leave to go to Vietnam, and they said that my dad had cried like a baby.
Wow.
Never seen him cry like that before.
Wow. So. While you were on leave, did you get a chance to see your brother who had just come back?
No, because he went from Vietnam to he got stationed down south. So no, I didn't get it. He got stationed in South Carolina, I believe, is where he got stationed.
Okay.
So no, I didn't get a chance to see him.
Okay. And when did you finally leave home and head over to the West Coast to get yourself to Vietnam?
It was in early December, in fact, I would say it was probably right around December 6th or something like that. I know I spent a week there, and I arrived in Vietnam on the 15th of December. So,
what was the trip over like?
Well, that was, of course, I flew, but
mm-hmm.
what I did do while I was home is I grew a beard, and you know, I didn't shave while I was home, and I was flying. You know, you would get that discount if you flew military, but you had to wear your uniform. So I figured, well, let me see how long I can go with this beard, and I actually reported for duty in Fort Lewis with a beard, a 30-day-old beard, and. So a lot of the people on the plane were kind of looking at me funny. What's this guy in the military with a beard for? Because at the time there was no facial hair except for the mustache. You know? And if I remember right, I think it went to Chicago, stayed on the plane, and went right on to Seattle, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got on the base, didn't take long, and the company manager grabbed me in the office and told me to go shave immediately or else I'd get an Article 15, so the beard disappeared.
Okay. What, when you got off the plane in Vietnam, what were your first impressions, thoughts?
Probably the heat was probably, I guess the heat probably hit me the most when I walked in. It was, and then I was surprised. I almost thought, like, oh my gosh, this is almost like a very secure area because there was a lot of people walking around. Nobody had weapons. There was actually, where I landed, Camram Bay, there was also, I guess, a civilian airport there because I saw, you know, civilians walking towards a small prop plane, you know, and it seemed like they were carrying their worldly possessions with them, chickens and everything else. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, this must be pretty secure. I'm not in a war zone. I do remember, and then the other thing that I knew it was probably going to be a pretty safe area when we landed because there were stewardess on the plane, you know, female stewardess.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured, well, they're not flying us right into a combat zone. But I did remember there was an elder office or an Air Force GI on there, and I guess when we started our descent into Vietnam, he started crying, and I thought that was unusual. But then, you know, I said, well, maybe he was here before, or, you know, he's got women, he's got a wife and some children, you know, so I figured, you know, it was an emotional moment for him. But I guess the thing that struck me the most when I climbed out of the plane was, you know, you're in this air-conditioned plane, and all of a sudden they open up the door, and you walk out there, and you're on the flight line, and the flight line is probably hotter than the surrounding area because it's a big blacktop area that just sets up the sun,
mm-hmm.
and it's just kind of like, wow, it's really hot here. It was even hotter than Texas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably the thing that struck me the most.
Mm-hmm. What was the atmosphere on the plane like? You mentioned the sergeant, you know, when you're descending into Vietnam, starting to cry. What was the general atmosphere for most of the flight over?
It was pretty quiet. I thought for the most part it was quiet. I remember I had a window seat, and I was looking out the window, and I was, you know, when we were descending in there, I was looking down, and I said, boy, what a beautiful-looking country. It was very lush green. You know, I remember. But basically, it was pretty quiet. I guess, a lot of people were probably doing some soul searching as they were flying in it. I really can't, you know, I just remembered it, he was a staff sergeant in the Air Force. He was the guy that stuck out the most in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But they were... You know, it was just like being on a regular airline. They were, you know, they served you some meal, you know, they offered you drinks, you know,
mm-hmm.
just like a commercial flight. I think it was, if I remember right, it was called Flying Tiger Airlines,
mm-hmm.
the name of the outfit that flew us over there.
Okay.
And I later on found out that there was actually a guy that flew prior to World War II for the Chinese. They were called the Tigers, and
mm-hmm.
and one of those gentlemen actually started that airline.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did you do when you got off the plane?
Well, when I got off the plane, at that point it seemed like it was pretty hustle bustle business. We went into the terminal, and they organized you and split us up and said, you guys are going here, get on that bus. And they sent us to what's called a replacement center.
Mm-hmm.
And the replacement center was, to me, as I look back on it, I think I would have segregated a little bit, because actually what they did was you got mixed in with the guys that were going home, you know. So the guys that were going home, of course, were telling you all these war stories and scaring the heck out of you, you know. So, telling you, you know, how bad it was and things like that, of that nature. So, if I was in charge, I think I would have separated them so that, you know, the old guys didn't scare the heck out of the new guys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very evident who was new and who was old by just looking at their fatigues. You know, the guys that had been over there for a year in that climate, they were all weathered, you know, and the guys that just arrived, they... spanking new green fatigues, you know. So they hustled you over, and then they when we got there, it was kind of late in the evening, and they directed us to the mess hall and showed us where which barracks we'd be staying in, and then there would be a formation in the morning. And so when I woke up in the morning, they started telling everybody where you were going, and when they got to me, they said that I was reporting to the 101st Airborne, and someone said they were up in Fubai, and the other guy I was with him says, "Oh man, that's up near the DMZ, man. That guy don't have half a chance, you know." Mm. So there was kind of like some teasing that with the old timers, you know, they would tease the new guys. Mm-hmm. So then, of course, the replacement center had a map of Vietnam, so after they told you where you're going, everybody was trying to look on the map to try and figure out where you're going, you know. And I found a little town of Phu Bai up there just below the city of Wei, and I said, man, that is up there pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So it was, you know, and Cam Ranh Bay was kind of a little bit north in Vietnam, and there were some, I guess, more central South Vietnam. There were some people who were going south, and, you know, I'm looking at the map and looking up there around the city to west, and, man, you can't get much closer to the enemy than where I'm going. And I thought the guys going south were actually had a better job, but here, you know, as I found out, it didn't matter where you were in the country, you know, the war was all over South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. So how did you make your way up to Phu Bai?
Well, what they did then is they put us on board a C-130,
mm-hmm.
and they it was basically set up to carry cargo, and on each side of the plane they had these seats that would fall down
mm-hmm.
from the wall. They could strap them up. Once they got cargo, they could drop them down. And actually, it was a mixture of both. You know, it was we had some cargo on board, and we were actually sitting on the outside wall. I don't think there were a whole bunch of passengers. It seemed like it was more cargo than passengers. And I thought it was kind of unique because as soon as we got up off the runway, it seemed like the pilot pointed the plane straight up in the air, and he climbed and got as much altitude as he could.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured, well, I guess he's doing that to get out of rifle fire or whatever. But I imagine he also did it to get away from artillery, outgoing artillery and stuff like that. And then he went out onto the coast and flew up the over top of the, I guess, the South China Sea. And,
mm-hmm.
and then and it was a reverse thing when we got there. It seemed like he'd come in high and nosedive down for the runway and
mm-hmm.
come in for a landing. And then when I got there, they said, well, you have to go up to Camp Evans for what they called in-country training. They sent everybody there, and they put us in some 2.5 trucks and rode us up Route 1 through the city away up to Camp Evans, and that's where they did the in-country training. And part of the in-country training was they actually did a... They put everybody in a helicopter and flew them outside the wire, mm-hmm. dropped them off, and then you had to march back to the camp. You know,
mm-hmm.
So that was actually part of the training. So I guess I did one combat assault where I got out of the helicopter instead of staying in it. And
mm-hmm.
and then from there they dispersed everybody, and I was assigned to the. To the 3rd Brigade, which was at Camp Evans, so I stayed there, and the other guy said, there was another guy that was in my group, he was an armorer, and he got stationed down at Fort Campbell, which was down around Phu Bai, so they loaded him up in a truck and sent him back down south. So, and then from there, I went to my unit, I was assigned to my unit there.
Did you ever link up with any of your former AIT classmates?
No, I never did.
Okay.
I never did. I guess they went. Everybody got orders from Vietnam after we got done,
mm-hmm.
and they were like 4 months ahead of me. So
okay.
I never did.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a photograph of them with all the names on the back, and I often thought, you know, I had to try and look them up, but. fact, I might do that in the near future. See how they made out. Mm-hmm. But no, I didn't. I never ran into anybody that I, either that or any of the guys from basic training. I never once left. That was it.
So your first unit of assignment, this was headquarters company, 3rd Brigade?
That's right.
Okay. And what did you understand in terms of your role and your mission as a part of that company?
Well, basically there was one other guy that come up through the processing. His name was Dave Woods, and he was a Loach mechanic. And when he got there, the captain told us that he hoped that both of us would become crew members eventually. Right now, there was no opening, and he said until then, he asked if we had any, what were our private skills. You know, I told him that, at the time I entering the service, I was an automotive mechanic. I worked at a gas station, and Dave Woods was a carpenter. Well, as soon as the CO heard that, he said, "Well, that's great." He said, "We need some stuff built," you know. And he asked me if I could help him, and I said, "Yeah, I could help him," you know. And so we ended up building a new latrine, and I believe Dave went on and built like a shower, but an opening came for a chance to fly, and I took that. I think I spent 2 weeks with Dave building that latrine. So, and actually, my first chance to fly was on a Loach. There was they had what they called a white team. I don't know. Are you familiar with that term?
No, sir.
Okay. Well, what a white team is they actually have two Loaches that go out and. They'll fly at treetop level, and they do an actual recon. They would actually fly around trying to locate the enemy,
mm-hmm.
and the other one would maintain a higher orbit away,
mm-hmm.
and they actually did some scouting for the 3rd Brigade. Mm-hmm. And so there was one guy that was a gunner on the white team that went on R&R, so they were looking for a gunner to fill in while he was on R&R.
Mm-hmm.
So, the captain asked me if, I would be interested in trying it out. I said, yeah. So I spent the first day, actually, we flew out to what they called was a fox box. It was an area that was like a 1 kilometer square area where there's no friendlies, and it's out in the jungle, and you can practice target shoot there. The fox box meant a fire box, that would be the practice shooting area. So the pilot would have me out there, and he would fly by a particular, he'd say, hey, see that bomb crater with the water in there? See if you can hit it with a machine gun, and he would fly by, and I would be trying to hit it with a machine gun. And after I got that down, then he said, try the M78 grenade launcher, and I would try that. And then, at the one point there, we found we come across a what looked like what they called a spider hole in the side of a mountain. It looked like a little man-made dig-in hole in the side of the mountain. And so he said, "Let's see if we can get one in there." He says, "But I don't want to hover in front of it in case somebody's in there; they'll shoot at us." He says, "Well, I'm going to fly by and you see if you can shoot it." So we're flying by this hole, and with the M78 grenade launcher, when you shoot it, you can actually see the projectile. It's a little blurry, but you can see it. And it was kind of funny because it was, I shoot at it and I go right at the hole, and then it seemed like just at the last second when it got close to the ground, all of a sudden it would turn in the direction that the helicopter was flying, and it would miss by 15 yards or something like that. It was kind of strange, and that's where I was talking about back in training, they should teach you a little bit more about firing from the air to the ground, because you actually almost have to lead your target, and so it was a little bit of a technique on that. And then he showed me how on the Loaches they had the minigun that was electrically operated Gatling gun, and the pilot would fire that, and he showed me how that thing would work. In this Fox box, there was a cliff, and on that, he hovered in front of the cliff, and he said, "Let me see if I can carve my initials in the side of this cliff." And when he pulled the trigger on the minigun, it actually, the force of the ammunition coming out of the minigun kind of tilted the helicopter back a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and it almost felt like from the hover it was pushing it back, you know. So it was kind of hard for him to control it. So he said, "Well, that's enough of trying to get initials on the side of it." You know? But it was I guess when he first opened that thing up, I had never been exposed to a minigun, and it was very noisy in it, and it didn't even sound like what you would think a regular machine gun. It almost sounded like a loud belch. You know, you almost couldn't pick out each round fire, and when it went
mm-hmm.
like that, you know, it was,
mm-hmm.
it was amazing. And so after we spent that day of training, then we went out, and of course there was two helicopters, so we would take turns, maybe a half hour down, scouting around while the other one was up covering overhead,
mm-hmm.
and then because after a while of staring into the jungle trying to pick up anything walking or anything that's not natural, you know, so, and you're doing circles, you start getting a little dizzy or whatever, so then you would change, you would shift over, the other boats would get down, and you'd go up and fly big donuts around them in case you had contact,
mm-hmm.
and we never did, in the week's time that I did it, we never ran into anything, but the idea was if you did see something, you were supposed to immediately throw a smoke grenade out,
mm-hmm.
mark the target, and then the other helicopter up high could hit it with a minigun, and then usually they said what they would do then was they would bring in a platoon of infantrymen to try and find out what they had there, or they would call artillery in on it, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then right after that, I got a job as I guess maybe, I don't know if it was also a combination of maybe the captain told the, you know, I spent a week with the Loaches to see, hey, how is he flying, you know, can he shoot a gun or something like that, because right after that guy come back from R&R, I went right to a UE, and I was first a gunner before I was a crew chief, and I spent, I guess it was probably over a month as a gunner before they actually ended up giving me my own helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
Where I was a crew chief.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were flying those Loach missions, the white teams, were there also Cobra gunships in your units and HK teams, the Hunter Killer teams?
Yeah. What they did was in our particular company, I was with the headquarters company. We didn't have any Cobras, but there was a Cobra outfit that was available for them, and then what they did was sometimes they would, when it was one Loach and a Cobra up high, they would call that a pink team.
Okay.
And then sometimes they would fly two Loaches and two Cobras,
mm-hmm.
and I believe they called that a red team.
Hmm.
So that the white team a lot of times did work with Cobras.
Mm-hmm.
They did do it in that fashion also.
Okay. And, you know, at this point, what do you understand in terms of what the United States is trying to accomplish in Vietnam, and where is your unit fitting into that?
What we're trying to do there is we were trying to keep the village people, the people who live in the town and the villages around it, free from harassment from the North Vietnamese soldiers. Is basically my, at that time there, that's basically what I was, believed what was going on. And it was almost like, it was very defensive posture. It was almost like, okay, we got all these people, and they're around. around the city away and all the villages around it, and we're here to stop you from coming in there and harassing them, killing them, or hitting them up for taxes, or things of that nature. Basically, when I first got over there, that's what I thought our role was. It wasn't a, to me, it wasn't an offensive, it was more defensive.
And what did you think the overall American scheme was? You know, what was the United States trying to accomplish in Vietnam?
Well, of course, basically to stop the spread of communists. That's would be the overall theme. You know, I know that was the, you know, I knew about the talk about the domino theory, about the, you know, one country falls to the communists, then they'll get the next one and the next one. So basically, you know, that was the overall view, was to stop the spread of communism. And you know, what I can, you know, I remember as a kid that, you know, President Kennedy was pretty inspirational, where, you know, in several of the speeches say that we will fight any foe, protect any ally. So, you know, if that was the mindset of the country, then I was performing that duty that he spoke of.
And what was the morale like at your unit when you got there?
I would say the morale in my unit, I think, was amongst the flight crews, I thought was on the high, pretty good morale. I think there was good morale there, and even within the guys that were the support for the aviation platoon, we had avionics guys, we had crew chiefs for the Loaches that didn't fly, they weren't gunners, and we were actually, you know, we were one aviation platoon part of headquarters company, 3rd Brigade, so there was, across the road from us was the, I guess the administrative end of the headquarters company. They did have a recon platoon that was across the road, and those guys, whenever they weren't out in the field, they would seem like they would come across the road and hang with us, because we were people that were, even though every night we went and slept in our bunks, we were actually out of the base, you know, I guess what you would say, fighting the war, where they didn't want to hang around with the clerks and I guess there was truck mechanics and that type of thing. So they, you know, they would hang with us. And I, for the most part, I think the morale was upbeat, I guess you could say.
Okay. And what was the relationship like? And actually, we can take this question back to your basic training in AIT. Relationship between different groups of people in the unit, for instance, along ethnic lines.
Okay. Well, in the ethnic lines, if I went back to basic training, my drill sergeant was a black gentleman, and my assistant drill sergeant was a Mexican American, and I would say that 90% of the guys that were in the my basic training platoon were white. There were some black soldiers and some Hispanic, but for the most part, I think they got along. I didn't really observe any racial tension in basic training. When I got to AIT, in my class there weren't any blacks. I guess maybe that could have been some racial discrimination in its own, that there wasn't any blacks, you know, within the that type AIT. And then the same thing when I got to Vietnam, the platoon that I was in, there was no blacks in that platoon. Well, there were blacks on the base camp, And I know there were, you know, there was, you know, some of the guys that were within the aviation platoon that weren't on flight status mm-hmm. told me, you know, hey, you go up to the PX during the day, you know, and if you pass by a group of black guys, they almost stare you down. You could feel the hate coming from them. Mm-hmm. You know, so there was that tension on the base camp, mm-hmm. although with my job, I really wasn't exposed to it too much.
Okay. And how about the relationship between officers and enlisted men?
Before we go there, the only thing I did want to say within the aviation platoon, mm-hmm. there was almost, since it wasn't black, so it wasn't a separation between some of the guys that I guess you, how we classified them over there was mm-hmm. there was juicers, they were the guys who would drink beer, and there was heads, they were the guys that probably would smoke marijuana or, mm-hmm. or whatever. So there was a little bit of tension there, you know. But I get, and maybe that's probably because there wasn't any. It seems like if you get a group of people together, they almost separate into cliques, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe because there wasn't any blacks there, that the whites busted up into two different cliques and became a little bit of tension there, but not too much.
Okay. The and what about between, since we're on the subject of kind of cliques, lifers and draftees, or regular Army and draftees?
There was definitely a little bit of tension of, between, it seemed like, within the enlisted men, sometimes the guys that hung, I guess the non-flight status, mm-hmm. the first sergeant would be the guy in charge, and he seemed like if he was pushing them too hard, they would say, I'd come back and at night, and they would tell me, oh, this guy's no good, he's a lifer, and stuff like that. All he wants to do is work all day, you know, but for the guys, we call them REMPs, the rear echelon mm-hmm. MFers, mm-hmm. and life for them was pretty boring because, you know, they were stuck on this base camp and within, you know, they couldn't go with the 101st Airborne Division. They wouldn't give you any passes to go into the towns or villages, so they were basically stuck to the base camp, you know, mm-hmm. so they were almost like a year in jail or something, you know? Mm-hmm. There was some tension there between the guys that received the orders and the guys that had to give the orders, I guess. Right?
Okay. And I guess while we're on that subject of giving and receiving orders, back to the question about enlisted and officers. And also, what was the makeup of the officer corps in your unit? Were there a lot of warrant officers or mostly commissioned officers?
Out of the pilots, I would say that 75% of them were warrant officers. And there were some commissioned officers that were pilot. Of course, our commanding officer and our XO, you know, were commissioned officers. And then we had a fellow that was the maintenance officer in charge of maintenance. He was a commissioned officer. And then we had, I think there was like, there was maybe two more that were just lieutenants that were pilots.
Okay.
But the rest of them were warrant officers.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that amongst the flight crews, I think there was a pretty good relationship between the two guys up front, the pilots and the two crew members, mm-hmm. Whether they were a warrant officer or an officer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you work together as a team. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed like after hours, the commission officers, they wouldn't mingle with the enlisted men, where the warrant officers would do it occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that would be the little distinction between
okay. the two. But you got along well with both warrant officers and commission officers?
Yes.
Equally well, or
probably, I think probably more so with the warrant officers, because a lot of the warrant officers were pretty young.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were pretty young guys. One, One guy we had was 19 years old, a guy from Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Hmm. Okay.
And so we did have some young warrant officers where the commission officers, they were more likely to be, 22, 23 years old,
mm-hmm.
That type thing.
Okay. Now, what about the organization? You mentioned that you'd crew together and you'd work together. How was your unit organized in terms of when you became a crew chief, and even when you were a gunner? Did you always crew chief and gun on the same aircraft and with the same pilots, or how did that work?
No, basically what happened was once you became a crew chief, they would assign you a helicopter, and that would be yours. You were actually the one individual that would never leave the helicopter. They could always rotate the pilots, which they did on a regular basis,
mm-hmm.
And the gunner, they could rotate, but for the most part, they left the gunner intact with the crew chief because, when I was learning the crew, they put me with a crew chief that had a lot of experience, and in order for me to learn what the duties were, after we would come in at the end of the day, we would perform all the maintenance that we would have to do on the helicopter, and then go and clean the guns. Well, supposedly the idea behind the way it was set up was the crew chief would take care of the helicopter and the gunner was supposed to take care of the guns, but the crew chief and the gunner basically worked together.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, they left that pretty much intact. In fact, when I was a gunner, I was with the same crew chief the whole time for that month and a half period, I guess it was. And then when I became a crew chief, I had the same gunner the whole time I was a crew chief.
Mm-hmm.
So that stayed intact. But the pilots would rotate. They would, I don't know what the purpose of that was. Maybe it was an effort to keep us from getting too close to them or whatever. I don't. But they had a flight operations would always, basically assign the crews. And they had a CQ, I guess it was called. He would come around, wake you up in the morning,
mm-hmm.
tell you, go get breakfast. You'd do that on the flight line in a half hour or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you wouldn't know. You'd go into the operation room, and they had a grease pencil board, and you could look on the crew and see who your pilot is, so you wouldn't even know to the next day who your pilot's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how that was set up.
Okay. So this will end the first interview with Mr. Haas. This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. David Haas on the 30th of March 2001 at approximately 5 minutes after 3 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Haas is in Mickleton, New Jersey. Sir, we left off last time with, we're going to discuss your first missions as a gunner in the Loaches. So why don't you go ahead and discuss that?
Okay, I believe last time I stated that they had put me in on as they asked me if I wanted to be a Loach gunner because one of the normal gunners was on R&R and they needed somebody to fill in for the week. And so I volunteered. And I think it was also basically they were trying to get a feel for me to see if I would be worthy as an air crew member and also give me an opportunity to get a feel for firing a gun from the air and stuff like that. And it was an interesting experience as it was, first opportunity for me to fly. And it was treetop level and everything kind of passed by below you pretty quick until we got into an actual area where we were reconning, and then we were like doing circles around and around and looking for any movement of any kind down there. And then, of course, like I said, there was some target shooting and things of that nature. We went to an area that was considered a free fire zone. There was no friendlies there. And we would pick out targets, and I would shoot at the targets and things of that nature. And needless to say, when I did get on the UEs, I was happier to be on UEs. It seemed like sometimes you would get a little dizzy when you're spinning around in circles like that. But it was a good experience.
Mm-hmm. Was there, you mentioned that you enjoy the Hueys more. Was there a difference, not just in the aircraft, but in the pilots that flew Loaches versus Hueys?
Yeah, I would say that the Loach pilots, they were more, they seemed like they were always Warrant officers. They were very young Warrant officers, and they were kind of like, I guess you could equate them to somebody that would want to ride a sports car instead of a Cadillac. And we kind of, when we talked about the two different aircrafts, that's how we referred to them. Even the pilots would refer to the Loach at the controls. When you move the stick, it would move instantly, and where the Huey was more like a Cadillac. When you hit the stick to move to the right, it would slowly turn to the right. It was a slower reaction than the actual Huey.
Mm-hmm.
And the Loach air crews, they were more gun-ho type, where they were interested in going out and looking for Charlie. And I would say that the Huey pilots were more content not to find Charlie, but they weren't afraid of him. But you know, they would just, you know, fly their missions. They weren't actually gun-ho as the Loach pilots.
Now, how long did you fly in Loaches?
Just for that 1 week.
Did you make contact?
No, I didn't make any contact.
Okay.
The only possible contact that we thought we may have had was we found what was a spider hole, and it was a hole in the side of the mountain, and they figured that it could have been an air tunnel or something like that, and I had unsuccessfully tried to shoot a couple M79 grenade launches in on it. And then the other Loach put the minigun down in the hole, and we reported it. But I don't know if they followed up on it or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And a lot of times, what they do, they would send like a platoon of infantry guys out there to check it out.
Mm-hmm. What kind of briefings did you receive as you were preparing for those missions on Loaches? Were you told anything when you got on board? Or before you got on board, what you would be doing?
Basically, the pilot went around the aircraft and kind of showed me what the Gatling gun was and told me that, you know, that he had operated it, and he had showed me when you sit on board the Loach, you would sit on the floor of the helicopter and your feet would be out on the skid,
mm-hmm.
and you would actually fire an infantry-style M60 machine gun that had the pistol grip, where in the Huey it had the butterfly grip,
mm-hmm.
and you would fire it right-handed and feed it with your right hand. You would have to feed it where in the Huey there was an ammo box down below. And we used a can of sea rations that we clipped to the side of the Huey type M60 machine gun, which had a butterfly grip at the end of it,
mm-hmm.
and it was actually hand freeze. You wouldn't have to feed it, so it was a little more difficult. And then also, of course, in the Loach, you had a harness that you would put on, and he showed me how to put the harness on, and it had like what we call a monkey's tail that you would hook to the floor so that should you lose your balance or something like that, you wouldn't fall from the helicopter. Because there was a lot of times where the helicopter was actually turned on its side as it's doing a donut, and you're actually looking straight down on the ground, almost laying parallel, it seemed like, with the ground.
Was there a risk when the aircraft went like that? Did the forward force, the motion of the aircraft, keep you in, or was it the harness that kept you in?
Basically, centrifugal force would
yeah.
keep you in.
Okay.
It'd be almost like, you know, if you're riding on a merry-go-round, it's trying to throw you off. Well, in the case of a helicopter, the floor is actually would be the outside edge of the merry-go-round. So
mm-hmm.
it was constantly, the G-forces were pushing you against the floor.
Yeah.
But I guess there would be a possibility that if all of a sudden the pilot would see a tree, and he would have to, if you're going in a right-hand donut, he would have to turn left or something like that, he could get jerked from the helicopter. And that's the case, then the harness that you had on, you would have that adjusted so it would hold you in place.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you put and you wore a bulletproof vest that would guard your chest. It was pretty thick armor. It was
mm-hmm.
probably, I would say, 3/4 to an inch thick, so it was pretty heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a chest shield covered it covered up over top of the shoulders, went down underneath the neck, and it went down to about belt line, and then it wrapped around almost like to protect your kidneys.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what did you take away from that experience that was important for you personally in terms of being a gunner?
Well, I think what it did, it sold me on flying. I really enjoyed the flying, the being up there to seeing the countryside, to not sitting in one place all the time, and also I learned a little bit about shooting from the air to the ground, that you almost have to shoot behind the target because the bullets would just as they get to the target, it would look like they all of a sudden they would shoot forward in the direction that the helicopter was traveling. So I did learn that, and I knew then that I wanted to fly
mm-hmm.
after that week's experience.
Okay. And actually, there was another question with regard to your. I was curious about pre-mission briefings regarding suspected enemy that you may encounter. Did you ever get told anything like that? We expect that, when we go into here, we might hit a squad, platoon, company, whatever.
No, basically, but they the only thing they did say that if you did see a target, that you would have to let the pilot know, and he would give you the okay. I guess they wanted to make sure that if should there be civilians in the area, that I wouldn't accidentally open up on civilians. But,
mm-hmm.
I was supposed to be in contact with the pilot if I saw something. And they did also say if you're flying by and you saw something, always had a smoke grenade ready so that you could throw it out, and that
mm-hmm.
would be a reference point. So that was covered. But it was really a pretty fast walk-around thing. I guess it was like 50, it must have been 15 minutes, but to me it seemed like 5 minutes, and I was getting a lot of information rather rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, off we went. But it was in the... It was in the jungle area, in the mountain area, so there wasn't supposed to be any civilians past the mountain line into the mountains. They were, the civilians in this area were allowed to be in the flatlands, but once you entered the mountains, there wasn't supposed to be any civilians.
Okay. So after your week with the Loaches, then you went on to Hueys.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and know, is this a completely different unit?
No, it was the same unit.
Mm-hmm.
And I was with Headquarters Company, 3rd mm-hmm. Brigade, 101st Airborne Division. And the UEs that I flew on were command and control helicopters. They they flew around, we had as high as a brigade commander, but mostly a lot of times it was battalion commanders, battalion XOs. Or we could be flying an artillery forward observer around in case if there's a fire mission. And, of course, there was a whole bunch of other little side missions related to that. Sometimes we might be called in to take a couple guys back from that came back from R&R after they're outfit in the field, or grab a guy or two from the field and take them back for R&R.
Mm-hmm.
We could be sent, asked to take a hot meal out to the guys in the field. Sometimes if you were in the area when somebody needed a medevac, you might be called in to do a medevac. All different kinds of missions.
Well, and did you stay with the CNC ships for the time you were in Vietnam, for the rest of the time?
Command and control CNC
mm-hmm.
ships, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the rest of the time I spent on
okay.
command and control ships. Yeah.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and discuss your first operation where you actually encountered enemy on the ground, where you had to fire?
Where I had to fire?
Mm-hmm.
I guess
Or where you were fired upon.
Or fired upon, okay. Yeah. Well, one of the, I guess one of the ones that I remember the most was there was a fire support base out in the mountains called Rakasan. We had just left that fire support base, and we were headed back to Camp Evans, and we were going past a mountain stream there, and I'd spotted two people doing dishes down in the stream. So we got on the radio to find out if there was any friendlies in the area, and they said no, there was no friendlies in the area. So we actually had turned and we did like a gun run, which it seemed like we were almost like a 1,000 foot up in the air, and we started diving down at these two guys cleaning their dishes in the stream, and we opened up fire on them, and I could see all the bullets ricocheting in the stream and everything. And it seemed like the one guy turned and he looked at us and just for a split second and took off into the jungle. And I couldn't understand how all these bullets were splashing in the water and we didn't get the guy. So they sent some infantry guys in there, and there wasn't even a blood trail. So it was pretty amazing. I thought those two guys were the luckiest guys in the world. And, you know, to see all those bullets landing all around them in the water and for them not to even take a hit.
Was that unusual or typical?
That
it was hard to hit targets from an airborne platform.
Well, it's actually, if you're diving straight on them, you don't have to lead the bullets or anything. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot easier if you're diving straight on them, whereas if you were shooting from a side target, you almost have to, like I said, shoot behind the target and let the bullets run up to them. Mm-hmm. But the bullets were on target. I just don't, for the life of me, I don't know how they missed, because, like I said, the water all around them, you could see the bullets ricocheting in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And, the M60s firing 550 rounds a minute. And I just, for the life of me, I don't understand how they missed it.
Mm-hmm. Now, was this, in particular, this mission, was it a reconnaissance mission, or what was the purpose of your flight there?
I believe we had just taken a couple guys out to fire support base Rakasan, and we were returning to Camp Evans. We didn't have anybody else on board that I remember, and we just happened upon these two guys in the stream.
Was that standard procedure that if you happened upon soldiers in a or what seemed to be soldiers in a free fire zone, if there were no friendlies in the area, you could shoot them up?
Yeah, that would be. Of course, you would have to, you would have to check and confirm that it was. There was no friendlies in the area.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happened to be that this was the pilot knew it was a free fire zone, and he did call back to the base to check and make sure that there was no friendlies in the area before we dove off.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And just to make sure that I understand completely, again, the area in which you were flying most of these operations, let's see, what was the nearest major Vietnamese village or city?
Okay, now the where we flew out of was Camp Evans, and the nearest village was a town of Phan Dien.
Okay.
And Phan Dien was probably, I would say it was located halfway between the city of Hue, and if you went northward to the city of Quang Tri. Camp Evans was located right between the two.
Okay.
And the village outside the base camp was Phan Dien.
Okay. Did you have consistent interaction with Vietnamese people while you were there?
The Vietnamese civilians? No, I didn't. The only one that I really had pretty good contact was with, there was a woman who was our hooch maid that I had pretty good contact with. That's about the only, we had a Vietnamese barber that would cut her hair.
Mm-hmm.
There were Vietnamese civilians that worked in the mess halls. There was an old papa son that we had an outside latrine, and his job was to the latrine was actually 55 gallon drums that he would pull out the back and burn off diesel fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was basically about the most contact that we had with Vietnamese people. They were civilians that worked on base.
Mm-hmm.
The 101st Airborne Division had a policy that they wouldn't give any passes to go out into town, so all villages and towns were off limits
mm-hmm.
to 101st Airborne Division members.
Okay. Now, so as you were working with the command and control ships, did you fly the battalion commander around or brigade commander around?
We would change off and on.
Mm-hmm.
But when I first started flying, I was flying the brigade commander around,
mm-hmm.
and then after a while, we'd switch to different battalion commanders.
Mm-hmm.
And but when the first mission, I believe his name was Colonel Harrison, was the brigade commander, and he left shortly after that. He became an advisor for the 1st Arvin Division.
Mm-hmm. Would you typically fly at a particular altitude when you're flying commanders around?
It would definitely it would depend on the situation where we were and everything, but
mm-hmm.
It was all different altitudes for the most part. A lot of times the battalion commander would use us as a recon ship. You know, we would go out there and he would want to check an area where his battalion's operating on, and we would be down there flying low, trying to scout out in front of an outfit that was moving along or something like that, or maybe there might be a company that's moving through the jungle and they want to confirm their position, and then we would locate where they were and then tell them, you know, they would tell them on the net that, yeah, you're where you think you are, or no, you're not, you're a little bit off,
mm-hmm.
you know, that type of thing. So we could be flying at all different altitudes. A lot of times, too, we would do, like if there was a combat assault, where they would insert the infantry into landing zones. We would go out and actually prep the landing zone for the insertion, and that would involve a lot of things. It would be most of the time what happened would be an artillery barrage on the landing zone for a period of time, and we might have a forward observer on board. He would adjust the artillery to the landing zone. And then one of the last things they would do was they would bring a Chinook helicopter in, and he had a sling load of 55-gallon drums that were loaded with foo gas, and would drop it on top of the LZ and burn the top of the LZ. And so we would direct the Chinook into the LZ. And a lot of times what happened to the crew chief would ignite it, the foo gas after it would land on there. The crew chief on the Chinook would do that. And sometimes if he failed to ignite it, we always had white phosphorus grenades. We would fly over and throw a white phosphorus grenade on top of it to ignite it to burn the LZ off. And then we would stay on station until the Armada Slicks would come in with the infantry company that they were inserting or whatever. So that was one of the jobs that we did.
Okay. What about, you mentioned in your questionnaire, just before Lamson 719, you guys did a reconnaissance. And I don't necessarily want to talk about that particular operation yet, but did you have experiences where you would fly a reconnaissance mission with commanders or with intelligence people, you wouldn't uncover anything, but later on people that went into the area would hit enemy?
Like you're saying, we would go out doing a recon mission,
right.
and then spot something. That,
or no, not you wouldn't find anything, but yet if a ground force went near it, they got hit.
Oh yeah. There were you know, a lot of times that would happen. So, sure, because we would be out there flying around. A lot of times
mm-hmm.
the North Vietnamese wouldn't want to be giving away their position
mm-hmm.
by shooting at a single
right.
Huey or something like that. So sure, they would they wouldn't give their position away, and so that would happen a lot. In fact, I did mention in that my questionnaire, I was surprised that as far as we went out Route 9, and because I can remember the pilots that when we were getting ready to go out Route 9, we went past Vandegrift. I think that was the last base camp that was manned by friendlies, and he says, we're going out to Indian country. And we flew real low level down Route 9. We were, you know, inspecting the road, I guess, see what condition it was in. I remember all of a sudden coming up on the big plateau of Quezon. It was almost barren red clay dirt, flying on behind that. And, you know, the place afterwards, you know, we found out that, you know, when we went in that area, the place was crawling with North Vietnamese, but yet they, you know, they didn't shoot us. I mean, it was amazing. You know, here we are, a lone bird all by itself, could probably shut us down.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody would know any different until we didn't show up. You know?
But they had the discipline not to.
Yes.
Was that typical for your experience, from your experience in general, well, for the year you were in Vietnam? That you know, what did you think of the enemy?
I think it, for the most part, it was very elusive, hard to pinpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of dictated when he wanted to when he wanted to attack, and it was seemed like he kind of knew what the the Americans were kind of like, we were in a routine, you know, we would get up the same time every morning to go to work, and we'd quit work at a certain time every night, so he basically knew our routine and could work around it. And in fact, one time, we were out early in the morning getting ready to lift off for the day, and we were in the procedure of starting a helicopter up. And the helicopter was—they were parked in these revetments. They were actually like steel walls on both sides that had sandbags. And they were probably about maybe 4 foot high, and they offered some protection in case there was incoming.
Mm-hmm.
That a round would land close to a ship, that maybe the damage wouldn't go to the ship. And we were inside the revetment, and we were firing up. And usually, when you would fire up the helicopter, you would, all the engine cowlings would be open, so in the event there was a fire, and either the crew chief or the gunner would man a fire extinguisher just in the case there was. And only the aircraft commander was on board. Everybody else was out inspecting to make sure everything was okay. And
mm-hmm.
I guess it takes about maybe three to four minutes to actually get the turbine engine running to a speed where the pilot can let off the starter. Well, I guess we were about 2 minutes into it, and all of a sudden you could hear rockets coming in, and they had went over our head, and I was standing behind the co-pilot, and we both instantly dove for the ground, and he ended up kicking me, his heel ended up in my face, and there was like six rockets that went right over top of the helicopter. There was like one right after another, and the first one landed, I would say, about maybe 150 feet from where we were, and then each one got a little longer. And we, you know, we had jumped down, and the pilot stopped or kept on starting up the helicopter. I guess he couldn't hear what was going on because he was inside the helicopter. And the first one landed next to our operations building. And when I was sprawled there on my stomach, I saw we had a clerk inside there, and when it exploded, I saw him running out and headed for a bunker, and he was holding his head like he was hurt. And when the round stopped, there were six of them real fast, and I said to the co-pilot, hey, I saw the clerk, he was headed to the bunker, and I ran over there, and he had his forehead was sliced. So I said, well, come on, we'll fly you down to Charlie Med. We took him back to the helicopter, and it was only a short hop across the base to Charlie Med. And then we went on our mission for that day, and we came back, and it was kind of a humorous story there. One of the rounds had scored a direct hit on a barracks, and the barracks were wooden plywood with tin roofs. And one guy had just got done off guard duty, and he laid down in bed, and all of a sudden he said, I feel thirsty. And he got up from his bed, and he walked to the other end of the hooch where the refrigerator was, and he was the only person in the hooch at the time. And the rocket come right through the roof and landed right in his bunk, and the concussion blew him out the door, but he wasn't seriously hurt or anything. But he talked about how lucky he was that he got thirsty all of a sudden. You know, he just got whizzing around when it landed right in his bunk. So that's something where I'd say that, you know, that the North Vietnamese noticed every morning there's all these air crews out there starting up their helicopters. That would be a good time to let some rockets loosen. So they saw that 6:30 every morning we would get up and go out and start up our helicopters, and so that's when they did the damage.
Did they rocket and water you every day or almost?
No,
every day?
No.
About
it was very. I would say maybe once a month, but no set pattern. You know what I mean? It could be like. You could get one day and one 2 days later and then not see any for 2 months, you know.
Wow.
Things of that nature. So there was no set pattern. They, I guess they tried to make it a point not to set a pattern. And then, of course, there, you know, there was ways of, the Army had ways of tracking where the rounds came from. So they would shoot their rockets and take off, you know. And they would only do a short six rockets and go. You know, they wouldn't sit there for a half hour pounding you because they knew they would get you.
Okay. Well, let me go back to some of your flying missions. In particular, I'm just kind of interested in what you remember about the command and control missions where you would fly either a battalion or even the brigade commander around. Did you ever fly any missions where you know they were actually in the air overseeing an operation on the ground? Supervising what was happening on the ground.
When there was a lot of times they would be up during they would go up while the company's moving or something of that nature. Where you're talking about an actual big engagement on the ground, and we were
Just movement, either movement on the ground, you know.
They would be up there. Flying around when there were these, you know, some of the outfits would be moving along through the jungles or things of that nature.
Would in the radio or the communication system, were you privy to the communication between the commander and the element on the ground, or just the internal aircraft communication?
Well, actually, sometimes we were privy to it, sometimes we weren't. What happened was on a command and control helicopter, there was actually a separate set of radios that were in the cargo compartment, and there was actually an RTO that operated them. And he would usually sit in the middle of the ship, and then there would maybe the brigade commander and whatever other officers that might be with him would sit on either side of him, and he would control the communication for the brigade commander, because there were several. A brigade commander would have several different battalions that he would be monitoring or things of that nature. Now when we went to battalion, usually the battalion had a single net. So our what would happen is the pilots would tune to the battalion net, and we had selector switches over top of my head where I sat in the back. There was a selector switch up there where you could there was like six different radios that you could listen to at any given time, or you know, you could listen to one at a time or two at a time or three at a time, whatever you wanted to. So sometimes we would hear some of the battalion network, but a lot of times it would be a little confusing because we would also have like the tower net for air traffic controller for Evans, or if we were working near a flyer support base, there would be a Pathfinder that had a net that we would listen to that would you know, that you would be calling in. We'd call in into him to get permission to land, and then also you would hear all the other traffic that was going on. And then also our platoon had its own net, so sometimes it would be a little confusing if you tried to listen to three nets at the same time. So a lot of times I would stay on the platoon net or along with a Pathfinder net or the tower net or something like that.
Okay. Well, when you were on operations where you had, where you were listening to all the communication between the commander in the aircraft and the commander on the ground, do you remember did you have any thoughts about how that worked? Do you remember anything in particular about how that worked?
Well, I can remember that. I believe I remember that some of the things, like some of the call signs, were always consistent. Like, numbers associated with it. Say if an example, they usually had Roadrunner would be maybe a name for one particular battalion or company within a battalion. Well, if you have, this is Roadrunner 6, well, that would be the company commander. Mm-hmm. So there was ways of if you're listening to the net, you would know, who's talking to who, that mm-hmm. type thing.
How about the nature of control, though? In that here you've got this guy up in this aircraft, he's kind of directing or trying to direct what's going on the ground, and you've got the guy on the ground that's dealing with whatever he has to deal with. Did you ever pick up on any kind of, problems, conflicts?
I can't really remember too many conflicts okay. that would stick out in my mind that I can really remember.
Okay.
I can't really say that I can remember.
Okay. Just curious. Well, why don't you go ahead and describe, some of your more memorable experiences flying in the CNC ships.
Okay, well, I guess one of the, like I said, one of the first times that when I was flying on command and control, we flew down to Camp Evans one day. It was prior to Lansdowne 719, and there must have been a big meeting down there as to what was going on. And when we got down there, Bob Hope was running a Christmas show, so we were told we would go to the Christmas show, so that was like a pretty good memory. And in fact, they had a lot of the Miss USA pageant girls were there, and the one from New Jersey was there, so I got pictures of her. In fact, I still got quite a few of those photographs of all the Miss Americans that were there. And then after that, it seemed like from that point on, Colonel Harrison, I guess he was, unknown to me, he was going to become part of the, he was going to leave the 3rd Brigade, 101st Airborne, and go to the 1st Arvin Division. I think he was one of the head advisors there. So we started doing a lot of scouting around in the future areas of operation, and we stopped at a lot of different base camps up there around Route 9, and some of the ones I remember was like there was one place called Neelock, which was in the flat grounds just below Route 9 before it turned into the mountains, and it looked like it might have been an old French fort. It was kind of square shaped looking, and it had a runway, a dirt runway, and when we landed there, it was a special forces camp with, and they had mostly Vietnamese mountain yards that were working for them, and it was the first time that I ever had seen the mountain yards up close. And we had parked the ship, and the colonel went inside and had a meeting, and I was able to, it seemed like all the family members were outside the perimeter along the airfield there, and I'm looking out, and I think the thing that stood out the most about the mountain yards were their feet. They would walk around barefooted, and when you look at their feet, they almost, their skin appeared gray like an elephant, and and they looked leathered, like they were they didn't need shoes. It was pretty amazing. They were primitive people, so that was an experience there. And then we stopped at another place called Camp Carroll, which was a little bit further north of that, closer to Route 9. And that was an Arvin base camp. And I remember running into, there was one American there, and his job was, he operated a Quad 50, and he took us back to his bunker. He had actually a rather large bunker, and he said that he was happy to see Americans, that he basically didn't see too many Americans at all, and we talked about, that he had a pretty good job, and the Arvins took good care of him, because if there was a ground attack, they knew that him operating Quad 50 there would save their butts. So he said they treated him well, they fed him well, they would get him women in there to take care of him, and things of that nature. So
okay.
It's kind of unusual to see this guy out there all by himself in the middle of nowhere. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And then we also had an opportunity to go out to some of the base camps that were right up there on the militarized zone. They were called like Alpha 1, Alpha 2, Bravo 1, Bravo 2. And it was kind of strange when you went out there, because you would follow the road. The skids would be almost right down on the road, and you would fly. And then just as you get to the base camp, you would flare up. You would go up in the air a little bit so that you could come down and land. And you would, if you were discharging a passenger or picking up a passenger, you would do it as fast as possible, because across the DMZ they were watching with field glasses, and as soon as they seen a helicopter land, they would cut loose with some artillery. And so it was funny, because when all of a sudden you flare up, you'd see the guys on the base camp scramble for bunkers, because they knew as soon as you got the North Vietnamese saw you, they were going to start shooting some artillery, and we'd drop somebody off and take off like hell, and you look back, and sure enough, you'd see the smoke coming up from the base camp there. They would fire some rounds at it. And the one base camp, I believe it was in Alpha 2, it was so close to DMZ that if you looked across the DMZ, you could see the red flag flying on the other side. So that was an experience. But it's out in the as you ran out Route 9 out towards Quezon, and you would leave the flatlands and go into the mountains. And I'll never forget that first trip out there when we were doing that recon. Route 9 followed like there was a stream that ran alongside of it, and it was absolutely a beautiful place. It was unbelievable. The stream would, as you're raising an elevation, it seemed like waterfall after waterfall, and it seemed like the whole area was all this gray rock, and there almost wasn't any soil, but yet the trees found a way to drop seeds in between the rocks and root and shoot up, and it was a very beautiful area. I've never seen anything so pretty as that area up there. And then there was an area that was called the rock pile. As you fly into the mountains, and QO Route 9 would hook around to the left a little bit, almost head south, and there was this lush valley that was green grass that was looked real dense, elephant grass and everything. And right in the middle of this big valley was a pile of gray rocks that could look like a giant had. One day they were just stood there and stacked all these rocks up onto a hill. So Vietnam was a very beautiful country. Trying to think of some other experiences that come to mind. Another thing that happened when we were out in that area, we came across a rainbow. And I said to the pilot, I said, well, look, why don't we fly to the other side? Maybe we'll find a pot of gold. So we started flying right at where the rainbow kind of arced into the side of this mountain. And we got to within about maybe what seemed like 50 yards, and all of a sudden the rainbow disappeared. And when we come out the other side of the rainbow, it reappeared. So something that I found that is, a rainbow actually occupies a space. It's not. You know, I thought as we got closer to the rainbow, we'd keep on pushing away from us, but it actually occupied the space. So that was a golden opportunity for me, you know, to do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that was pretty neat that it did on a helicopter was one time it was during the monsoons, and we hadn't seen the sun in a long time, and the pilot says, hey, how about we go up and take a look at the sun? So we said, yeah, let's go. And off we went. And when we broke through the dark gray clouds, it was kind of strange to me. All of a sudden we pop up the top, and the tops of the clouds are all bright white, and it was almost blinding. That we put, all of us quickly put on our sunglasses because it was really, really bright. And I'm looking out my door, and the top of the clouds almost, to me, looked like it was, we were flying over top of a large snow field or something of that nature, like you could almost step out and walk on it. And the pilot put the skids right down in the top of the clouds and did a slow right turn. And when it looked back, he had cut a path in the top of the clouds with the rotor wash, and both ends of the clouds were lifting up in the air and turning back into the path and doing a swirl. So that was kind of like an unusual experience. It was pretty neat. And
did you guys take fire much from the ground when you were flying?
For the most part, not too much, because a lot of times, like when we did fly, we would fly at treetop level. So if you happen upon someone and we're doing like 100 miles an hour, and if you're in a triple canopy jungle, and if you hear a helicopter coming, it's bouncing off the trees, you can't tell where it's coming. So as we flew along at treetop level, by the time they actually saw us, if they were to try and raise a weapon or something, we'd be gone that fast. So a lot of times, only a couple times going into landing zones or coming out of landing zones did we take fire, that would be, but not necessarily just flying from point A to point Z. Usually you wouldn't receive fire. But remember I was telling you in the Loach that there was we called it a chicken plate. It was an armored vest that you would wear on your chest. Well, if we weren't going into an LZ, a lot of time what we did was we would take that thing off and put it on the seat and sit on it, and that piece that would wrap around your kidney I was telling you about, well, you would put that between your legs to protect the family jewels. And so if somebody, you know, somebody could take a pot shot at it, that it would come up through the floor, and then you would have some protection. The pilot sat in an armored seat, so they had the protection, where the air crew didn't have the protection. We sat on a nylon seat. There was no protection from below.
Did your aircraft get hit much?
No. As a matter of fact, the whole time I was over there, my aircraft never took any rounds, took some shots, but never got hit. In fact, it was kind of funny because all the pilots used to make a joke. They used to say, well, let's fly with Hawsey. He's lucky. You know, he never gets hit. And then when I was getting close to the point when I was coming home, they started to change to, hey, don't fly with Hawsey. He's due. You know? So, no, my aircraft never took any hits. I never had to do any skin repair.
Mm-hmm.
So I was pretty lucky that way.
Yeah. Now, okay. Any other particular incidents that you can remember or recall that were noteworthy, you know, maybe encountering wildlife or anything like that?
Encountering what? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Wildlife? You know, elephants or tigers?
Yeah. One time when we were doing a recon mission and we're flying just above the treetops, and we went across a stream that you wouldn't even notice. It was a real narrow stream, and I saw an elephant and a young behind it, and the young had its trunk tangled with the mother's tail, and it was trudging up the stream, headed up this hill. And I said to the pilot, I said, hey, turn around, come back. I just seen an elephant. And we turn around and we come back, and we searched and searched and searched and never found the elephant. And it's kind of hard to believe a big animal like that, we couldn't find it. And, I, of course, I got teased. Everybody was saying, hey, has he seen a pink elephant, you know. And then, of course, a couple days later, another air crew had spotted it in the same area. So it kind of made me feel like, whoa, I really did see an elephant.
Uh-huh.
You know? I was kind of second-guessing myself after a while.
Right.
And then there was, I guess, in some of the streams you would see, I guess over there would be a crocodile, not an alligator, right?
Mm-hmm.
You would see them floating in the streams there. You would see, one time, I remember one air crew came across a deer, and they had it, they shot it and dropped down and sling-loaded and brought it home, and they had, it was across from the runway from us. They had a big barbecue that night. They had deer meat that night. So, you know, there were some animals over there. I'm trying to think of some of the other... and one time I was... there was a place a little bit south of us called a section of a river that broke into Three Forks, and we called it Three Forks. It was a marker point that was from the city away going up to Camp Evans, and, you know, sometimes you would, if you're calling Camp Evans for permission to land, they would ask where you were, and you would say, oh, we're down around the Three Fork River. And we were doing some recon around there, and there, between Camp Evans and the mountains, there was a fire support base called Jack. And we were down on the surface pretty good. We were looking for, there were some reports that somebody had seen some sandpans in the river there, and they weren't supposed to be there, and they thought maybe they were running supplies. So we were searching the area pretty good. And all of a sudden, I just happened to, out of my peripheral vision, I seen fire support base Jack just blow up. Looked like a blown up. And so I said to the pilot, I said, it looks like fire support base Jack's taking incoming. So we headed over that way, and then the pilot got in touch with him, and here what had happened was the base camp was struck by lightning, and all the Claymore mines around the perimeter had gone off all at one time. And fortunately, nobody was hurt, because a lot of times the guys on the base camp would be out there some days and on the bunkers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they even set off some of the, they had two gas drums that were buried down in the ground, 55-gallon drums, that in the event that there would be an attack at night, they would light them up, and it would act like a flare to light up the perimeter so that the enemy, some of them were on fire and everything. So that was an unusual sight that I
mm-hmm.
I saw.
And it's certainly not something you think of is, you know, lightning. Of course, all the claymores are if they're command detonated or whatever, no matter what, they're electrically detonated.
Yeah, so, they're electrically detonated.
So,
right?
Yeah, a high-charged lightning strike would detonate them.
Yeah, just set them all off. Yeah, it was unusual.
Mm-hmm. Had you ever heard of anything like that before?
No, that was the first and the last time I ever saw anything like that.
Okay.
And then, talking about that Three Forked River, that
mm-hmm.
we were down there running that one time. I guess we got another report that there were some sandpans operating in it, and they were, at that time I had been, this was after the operation in Laos, and I became a crew chief, and I had a French-Canadian for a gunner, and he spoke better French than he did English, but, you know, we were able to communicate with him pretty good, and of course his nickname was Frenchie, and we found the sandpans, and they were actually headed out of the flatland, just about ready to go into the mountain, and we were hovered in front of them, and we were trying to tell them, no, you can't go here, waving them back, but they kept on going towards the mountain. So the pilot said to Frenchie, he says, look, he says, put some rounds down in front of them so that he knows we mean business. Well, when Frenchie cut loose, he must have put them like 2 foot from the sandpan. And
the pilot went crazy. He said, "What are you doing? You're shooting it. You just about shot the guy. You're going to put holes in his boat, sir." So, but the guy got the message. There was two of them. They turned around and went back the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think of some other things that happened over there. Oh, one time one of our loaches crashed. Like I said, they work in teams of two. And that particular day, I was my aircraft was down for maintenance. Every 100 hours, you'd have to bring it down and do some extensive maintenance. It would take at least a day to do most of the work. And we got a call on the platoon net that a loach had crashed. And one of the pilots who were off duty come running over to me, and he said, it was lunchtime. He come down to the hooch. He says, "Hey, look, we got a loach down." He says, "Can you come with me?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll come with you." And I grabbed an M16, and when he was a loach pilot, and I had flip-flops on, shower shoes on, and went running to the loach, and got on board the loach and sat in the front seat. And I looked around. There wasn't even a helmet, so I didn't even have communication with the pilot except for a howling across to him, and I couldn't hear what was going on to the net. But what had happened, what found out later on, was they were doing treetop search, and the pilot hit the tail rotor up against a tree, and mm-hmm. and the blades come flying off, and the thing. And the loach was pretty well designed. If it crashed, the tail boom would go off, and basically just the cab would stay intact. And the way they got them out of there was they lowered a rope from a slick, mm-hmm. from a Huey, and the pilot got on the first, and the gunner got on the second, and they picked them up out of the jungles and took them over to a stream and then dropped them off there, and then they were able to go down and pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
But I was talking to the gunner afterwards, and he said he was at the bottom of the rope, and the pilot kept on losing his grip and sliding down on him. He said he was scared to death. He thought he was going to fall from the rope because he kept on hollering at the pilot, climb up. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So... that was, but it was amazing how many aircraft responded to it. In fact, it was almost, I thought it was dangerous in the area because it seemed like there was like 100 helicopters flying around this one down loach. You know? And you know, as a pilot, you had to keep your eye out so you didn't have a mid-air collision. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, but then everybody got organized and went in the same circle. So, but if you call on the... a mayday in, it seems like you get a lot of people that wouldn't respond. It seems like they drop whatever they're doing and go to try and help another air crew. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see some of the other things.
I'm curious. Did you guys at this point, did you know about the Vietnamization program that Nixon was putting into place to, you know, to turn the war over to the Vietnamese?
Yeah, basically, you know, we were aware of the Vietnamization. In fact, at the end of my tour, 101st Airborne was standing down, and the Arvins were taking over our air operation. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, we basically were familiar with it. Of course, it was going on before we actually went over to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and it was kind of funny because when I first got up in that area, there wasn't that many Vietnamese soldiers in our area of the operation. The only thing that there were some police that operated in the villages, but we started seeing like a lot of times what would happen with the Vietnamese Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
They took over flying helicopters. So and what would happen would we'd be flying around, and of course you always listen to Camp Evans, air traffic controller, and all of a sudden you hear the air traffic controller calling for an unidentified UE coming at the base camp to identify himself, and then all of a sudden the next thing you know, the air traffic controller would say that he would say, "Apparently, I got a VNAF helicopter coming from the south. Please be aware, I have no contact with him." You know, and the guy would fly right into the fuel dump and load up his helicopter and off he'd go, and you know, he would never even call the tower or anything. So it was a little confusing that way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That type of stuff happened.
Yeah. But I'm curious, did that have an effect at all on the morale of the unit, knowing that here the policy is Vietnamization, turning the war over to the Vietnamese? Obviously, you know, the handwriting's on the wall, U.S. forces are withdrawing. No one wants to be the last person killed.
Right, yeah, there was a lot of, you know, there was talk about that, but, you know, I don't think it ever hampered the air crews. I think that every day, you know, they went out and did their job. I don't think anybody did anything like fake missions or anything of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you had a job to do, you went ahead and did it.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, it was a little discouraging the fact that, you know, we weren't finishing the job over there, you know, that type of thing. But maybe amongst some of the rear echelon guys, or maybe some of the ground pounders or something like that. But the air crews, you know, we took our job serious, and for the most part, you know, we did our job.
Was there any change in the morale for the time that you were there, or from the time you got there to the time you left? Did morale change at all?
Not that I noticed, no. Not that I could notice.
Okay. And how about, well, we already talked about racial conflicts and stuff like that, didn't we?
Right, right. Yeah. And I...
The racial tension, that
kind
of stuff.
Yeah, basically said that, you know, within our platoon, we didn't have any blacks, so
right.
It really wasn't a problem.
Right.
But I also said that could have been discrimination in itself. How come there wasn't any black air crew showing?
Yeah.
So,
now, did you ever, were you ever subject to a urine analysis?
Yes, on the urine analysis test was done when I left the country.
Mm-hmm. Oh, just when you left?
Yeah, what happened was when you reported to leave, they went down. When I flew out of Da Nang,
mm-hmm.
And what they did was they said that, okay, you're here. Between now and 5 days, we're going to schedule you for a flight. We're not going to tell you what day it is,
mm-hmm.
But before you get on the flight, you have to give a urine test. So I guess it was, you know. You knew you were going to give a urine test, but maybe, I guess they figured maybe the hardcore drug addicts, they would procrastinate or say something like, well, it'll probably be 5 days so I can do something and it'll be gone out of my system or something like that. But that was kind of interesting. What happened to me was that I had gotten up early in the morning. I had got my shower. I went to the mess hall. Came back and used the toilet and everything, and all of a sudden there was a morning formation, and they say, okay, your flight leaves in an hour and a half, but you have to give a urine sample. Sure, well, I just use the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
So they put you in a latrine, and you weren't allowed to leave the latrine until you gave the urine sample.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm telling the guy, I said, well, look, I don't want to miss my flight. I said, And he says, well, maybe you can get one of these guys leaving and go get you something to drink. So when one of the guys, I said, hey, go over to the mess hall, get whatever you can, you know, and bring it back. So I'm down in all these, I think it's orange juice, milks, chocolates, and stuff like that. And finally, just at the last minute, I was able to give a urine sample in time. And when I get on the Freedom Bird and we fly out of there, everybody's falling asleep except for Dave, because every 10 minutes, Dave has to get up and go to the bathroom the whole flight home. You know, that's the only...
That's the only urine analysis.
The only urine analysis that I had to give.
Okay. This will end CD number one of the interview with David Haas. This is CD number two of the interview with David Haas on March 30th, 2001. You mentioned before that you conducted medevac. And obviously, you were around when they picked up the Loach pilot that went down. How many other similar missions did you conduct in terms of medevac missions and rescue missions?
I remember. I can remember two medevac missions. Any other rescue missions of that nature, where we're actually on the scene like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I know during the during Lamps on 719, there was like I believe there was a little bit over 600 helicopters that were involved in that operation, and there was like 115 received such bad battle damage that they weren't able to return to the air. So there was there were quite a few downed helicopters. There was a pretty bad time for helicopters that part of the war there. I think there may have been more helicopters shot down in that two-month period than any other two-month period during the Vietnam War. It was pretty good. But most of that was over in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
One of the medevac missions that I pulled one time, we just happened to be in the area. We go in and pull this guy out that's shot in the chest.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during Lamp 719, and we flew him to Quan Tri, and he was dead on arrival. And here, what had happened was his best friend shot him, and they said it was over C rations. And then we also went back and flew the guy out that did the shooting and took him to the we took him back to King of Heaven,
mm-hmm.
turned him over to the military police. Another medevac mission that I did, it was a guy that had, which he wasn't wounded or anything, but it was from the heat. He had heat exhaustion.
Mm-hmm.
And we had picked him up and en route to Charlie Med. He stopped breathing, and I had to give him mouth-to-mouth artificial respiration.
Mm-hmm.
And we took him to Charlie Med, and later on we were flying around, and the battalion commander had called the on our platoon net and thanked me for what I had done for his soldier.
Mm-hmm.
They were two medevacs that I remember. I'm probably sure we've done other ones, but they're the two that stand out in my mind. I'm sure.
Okay. Well, okay. Why don't you go ahead and discuss Lamps on 719 and the role of your unit in that operation? What you know, what you understood the operation to be, and how you guys fit into it.
Okay. From what I understand, the role of the operation was to go into Laos and disrupt the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which was the supply lines for all the manpower and munitions that were coming from North Vietnam down into the South. And the idea was to go in there and raise some havoc on it. And so basically the caisson base camp was going to be the staging area, and caisson was last occupied, I guess, by the Marines back in 1968, and then it was abandoned and hadn't been occupied since. So there was one of the things I guess that they were concerned with was to keep the supply line open to caisson, and one of the major supply line was Route 9. And during the siege of Quezon with the Marines, Round 9 wasn't open, so everything had to be supplied by the air, and they didn't want that to happen again. So they assigned the 3rd Brigade, 101st Airborne Division. That was our job to keep Round 9 open from Dong Hao up to Quezon. And then I believe from Quezon to the border was actually the 1st or the 5th Mechanized Infantry, but one of our outfits, I believe it was the 3rd or the 187th, was assigned to the 1st of the 5th Mech, so they actually ended up keeping open the rest of Route 9 from Quezon to the border. So the 101st Airborne, that's what the ground troops, that's what their job was. The other job for the 101st Airborne was they took charge of all the air crews that flew the Army soldiers to and from Laos, and the AFCON, I believe, a bunch of other aviation houses from around the South Vietnam, up in that area. I believe the 101st, their job was to run that. So we had a pretty major job there, and did a pretty good job at it, I believe. The only thing that was the biggest blunder of the whole operation was the fact that when the Arvins went into Laos, they weren't allowed to take their advisors with them. No U.S. ground troops were allowed into outside the South Vietnamese border. So when they got to the border, the U.S. Advisors had to leave their the Arvin troops, and they went by themselves. So there was a communication breakdown. You know, all the air support was American, and all the ground were South Vietnamese, and the communication, just the language barrier in itself was a problem. And so it wasn't as productive as they thought it could be, and that was probably the major problem. But the for the most part, I think the Arvin soldiers did the best they could do with what they had. But in the end, when they started pulling out of Laos, the North Vietnamese were right on their tails, chasing them out of there. Mm-hmm. And some of the air crews that were flying, pulling them out, said that when they were pulling them out, there was, you know, they could fit like 8 to 10 Arvins on a UE, or they would be trying to swamp the plane, you know, and that helicopter, and they'd be hanging on skids. So a lot of the air crews said they would have to carry blackjacks so that they could beat them off the side of the helicopter on the way out so that they could get airborne.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we heard stories about some of them would hang on for a while, and then they couldn't hold on no more and drop. And, you know, we heard those type stories. I think it was a shame that the advisors couldn't go with them, or some American ground troops. But I think there was the U.S. Congress passed some bill saying that that no American troops could leave South Vietnam. I think it was sponsored by a gentleman by the name of Carter, if I'm not mistaken. Not the president, but a Congressman Carter or something like that. I can't really remember the name. But that was a result of when they went into Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
There was such a public outcry that now our boys are not only dying in South Vietnam, now they're dying in Cambodia. And it really was a shame, because, you know, that was their supply route, and if you could break down the supply route, then, you know, maybe they would have lost the will to fight. You know? But that's the way it was perceived stateside, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it was finished, what did you guys think?
When we were finished with the operation?
When Lim Sun 719 ended, what did you think? What did you and the other soldiers in your unit?
Well, I guess we looked at it as our job was to keep keep Round 9 open, and we did that. So we accomplished our mission, you know. And I guess that was the basic feeling, you know.
Did you have a sense of the bigger picture, what actually happened at the time?
I didn't really have a real good feel of what was going on in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a general idea, but I'm not to the extent that I later read about. You know, since I've been in a home, I've read a couple books on it. But for the most part, I think everybody felt pretty good about what they did.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the best that we could do.
Mm-hmm.
Kept the road open, you know,
right.
Never shut down.
Right.
There were a lot of ambushes and stuff like that, and we reacted to those ambushes, and that was an accomplishment in itself, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping the road open.
Now, but what did you guys think? You know, as you're a major of your time, you know, while you were there. What did you hear and what did you think about the Vietnamese and how they conducted themselves, the Arvin?
Oh, the Arvins? You know, there was a lot of, you know, I've heard a lot of the guys talk about, oh, they're no good and stuff like that. They're lazy, they don't fight as hard and stuff like that. There was a lot of bad mouthing of them, you know, for the most part. But they, I think for the most part, I think they proved themselves. You know, they, I guess right after I left there, there was right in the area where I was at, there was the North Vietnamese launched that Easter Offensive, they called it. And they actually captured the city of Quang Tri and everything else. And but then the Arvins finally did chase them back across the border. But there was, when they did capture the city of Quang Tri, there was one of the main reasons that they did was, I don't know, did you ever see the movie called Bat 21?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was an Air Force major was shot down, and
yes,
and he was right near the demilitarized zone.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened when he got shot down, he they put a no-fire zone around him where the Air Force wouldn't drop any bombs. They requested that no artillery be shot in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened was, as the North Vietnamese were coming down Route 9, they got to Dong Ha. There were some American advisors blew that bridge, so they headed west to a town called Cam Lo, which was right near where Bat 21 was.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to blow that bridge there, but they weren't allowed to because Bat 21 was on the ground. So they were actually able to. And of course, the North Vietnamese tanks, they weren't getting shot at by aircraft or anything, so they were able to just run across the DMZ and down and capture Quang Tri because Bat 21 was on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the movie, they depict that, I guess there was an Air Force pilot that saved them, but in real life it was a South Vietnamese soldier that went in and rescued them and pulled them out.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, from what I understand, that particular South Vietnamese soldier was the only Vietnamese that received an American Medal of Honor.
Mm-hmm.
So, but once they got Bat 21 out of there, they pushed them back across the border.
Mm-hmm.
So, for the most part, I thought they were, after reading stories about that, that, you know, they held their own,
mm-hmm,
the Arvins.
Okay. And is there anything else about your in-country experiences that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, there was it was quite a I guess there was quite a few things there. After the after Lansam 719,
mm-hmm,
we went back into the Ashall Valley area.
Oh, okay.
And I guess that was a follow up to it, because the Ho Chi Minh Trail ended up into the one of the forks that come off and went into the Ashall Valley. And it was an interesting experience. It was a very windy time of the season. There was one particular mountaintop that was called Eagle's Nest that sat real high and overlooked the valley. And I remember one time we sat down on top of there to pick up a couple GIs, and the pilot said, "Look at the airspeed indicator." And I looked over and it said 50 knots. And when you're flying in those real steep mountains with that high wind, the helicopter gets bounced all over the place. It was like being on a roller coaster ride. It was quite an experience. And then there was one base camp out there called Catherine was the name, and it had a real narrow LZ landing zone on top of that. In fact, when you sat down on it, it was probably only about 8 foot wide, and the pilot would be looking down the face of one side of the mountain, and sitting in the back door, you'd be looking down the face of the other side of the mountain. That's how narrow it was. And of course, you had the high winds. It was it was quite an adventure to try and land on that one. And then they found out in that area, they found an NVA hospital complex that was all underground in this one mountain. And when they found it, they had reported it, and a TV crew wanted to go out there, so we got selected to fly the TV crew out there. Well, there was no landing zone, so the first thing they did was they lowered some chainsaws down to the guys on the ground there, and they started cutting an LZ. And when we went out there, it was real tight. It was almost the helicopter could just fit in the LZ, so it was like hovering down the chimney almost. And it was real good coordination between myself and the gunner talking to the pilot, because he couldn't see back, so we had to tell him to the sides and where to back, you know, move this way, move that way. And when we got close to the ground, here the tree stumps, when they cut them with the chainsaw, they were sticking up like 3 foot high or so, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we were trying to line up the skids so where we could land and not hit a tree trunk. And the whole time I had my arm out telling the air crew, don't go, don't go, and until we touched down, you know. So then we're getting ready to touch down. It felt like we hit a trunk, so I leaned over to look and see what was going on, and they took my arm down, and the air crew jumped out, or the TV crew jumped down,
mm-hmm.
and the bird started rocking. And so it really pissed me off. So when you're going in, you have your gun on one hand, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I kind of pointed the gun at the camera guy, and he did the smart thing. He pointed the camera right back at me. You know, go ahead and shoot me, but the whole world's going to know.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so that was an experience.
Mm-hmm.
Is
that the only time you dealt with the media?
Yeah, for the most part, yeah, that I could remember. Yeah. And I often wonder. I wonder if that clip was on the on the news, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Back home. Another thing that I saw was one time the Air Force. Dropped, I believe it was called a 10,000-pound bomb. You ever
mm-hmm.
hear one of them?
A daisy cutter?
Yeah, they roll it out the back of a C-130,
mm-hmm.
and it's on a pallet with a parachute,
mm-hmm.
and I guess it's command detonated by the crew chief. When it gets to treetop level, he hits a button, and she goes, and we were out watching that, and we were a good ways off, and that thing blew, and it seemed like maybe 30 seconds later, all of a sudden, we got all this rain of wood chips coming down on the helicopter. And it made a great big mushroom cloud like an atomic bomb. Cleared a great big LZ. They were landing
mm-hmm.
five and six helicopters at a time. I saw that. Let's see, what else did I see? Oh, I saw one of the last Australian bombing missions. They had a big black bomber plane. We were told that that's it. They were pulling out.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to think. Oh, another time, there was an Arvin base camp that was kind of like to the north and west of where we were at Camp Evans. And I believe the base camp was called Fire Support Base Ann.
Mm-hmm.
And the one night we heard that they were getting this ground attack. And we could see off in the distance all the flares up in the air and the mortar rounds landing, the artillery rounds landing. And so the next day we flew in there,
mm-hmm.
and the place was just littered with North Vietnamese bodies, all in the wires, tangled and everything. And I remember remarking to the pilot, saying, look how big those guys look. They didn't look like they were Vietnamese. He said, oh, they're probably Chinese, because they were like the size of Americans, you know, and most Vietnamese were kind of small guys.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of got the impression that they were probably Chinese mercenaries or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to think if there was. Oh, there was another thing that happened one time was the city of Phan Dien, which was right outside our base. I guess the powers that be felt that maybe there were some Vietnamese in there, or there was a lot of the drug traffic that was getting onto the base was coming through there. So what they did was they had like a night raid on the on the town, and they did it with Arvin's soldiers, but they surrounded the town with American soldiers, but they let the Arvin police, I guess they were called SQs, or I can't remember exactly what they were called, but they had initials on their helmets, and the Arvin police went into the town and did a search and everything, but the that night we were flying, around command and control out around the outside of the town. Well, here one of the flares that they shot, the parachute failed to open, and the flare landed right on a hooch and set it on fire, and we got called in and we had to medevac. There was a little baby that was all burnt, and we flew him back, the baby back to Charlie Med.
Oh, no.
Then we did hear later on that the baby did die.
Oh.
And the worst part about it was they found no weapons and no drugs in the whole town.
Oh.
So that was a horror story from over there.
Now, do you know how that was handled in terms of,
what they did for the family?
Yeah.
No, I don't know how that was handled.
Well.
But I just remember landing and the mother come running to the helicopter and the baby was wrapped up in a blanket and she ran to the and handed it to me while she climbed aboard.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even want to look. You know?
Yeah.
Because we knew we were going in for a burned baby.
My goodness.
That was a sad story.
Yes.
Trying to think if.
Did your company take many casualties while you were there? That is, did Americans working in HHC, third of the 101st, get injured much?
The headquarters company.
Yeah, guys.
We had one guy that was infantry MOS, but he was working as a supply sergeant, and all of a sudden he went back to infantry. And the word was that he was pissed off at the company commander, and he was tired of being in the rear, and he went back out in the field. And it was right as there was an alpha that got attacked at night, and it was right at the foot of the mountains. Past fire support base Jack, and they were getting fired upon from up in the mountains at night, and they said that this sergeant, he was a sergeant, he just grabbed his M16 and started running up the side of the mountain like a madman, took a bullet right through his head. His name was Sanchez, if I remember right, and he's about the only guy that I can remember that I knew personally that was killed over there, because none of the air crews, we didn't have anyone that was killed.
Okay.
We had some injuries, but no kills.
Yeah. Okay.
Which was good.
Yeah.
In fact, it was kind of crazy because when I got out of the Army, they offered me an early out to spend a year. I had a year left. They said, well, if you spend a year with the National Guard in your hometown, you can get out early. So I said, okay, good. And so I signed up with the 112th New Jersey National Guard, and we went away to summer camp down at Camp Pickett, Virginia. And it was a two-week thing, and we went to Virginia Beach if you wanted to on the weekend, and we come back from Virginia Beach and hear the motor pool sergeant and two other of his guys, they took a Jeep and went out on the firing range, and they were collecting souvenirs. They put 2 dozen rounds in the Jeep, and they hit a bump, and it blew, and all three of them guys got killed. So here I am stateside with a National Guard outfit, lose three guys. And mm-hmm. Over Vietnam a whole year, and we only lost that one guy.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and turn to something a little bit less serious. I was curious about entertainment. What you guys did for entertainment while you were there?
For the most part, there was an officers club and an enlisted man's club, and a really basically all they had in the listening club was cold beer. There was no actual hard liquor or anything. Mm-hmm. We were at the end of the supply line, so that's about the only thing that we could get. And, of course, there was a, I believe there was a dartboard there. They played music. It seemed like it was mostly country western music. One of the things that I, me and a bunch of the guys used to do quite a bit at night was play chess. And I had a refrigerator in my hooch, and I always kept it stocked with beer. And a lot of us would get together, and the other fellow that was shared the hooch with me, he had a stereo system, so we had music. And a lot of times, that's what we would do to pass the night away. There was a couple guys in the alphabet that played guitar. Another guy, I think he played a harmonica.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and basically self-made entertainment. There wasn't. There may have been somewhere on base where they played movies, but it was either too far away or it wasn't, you know, within our outfit, but I can't ever remember watching a movie over in Vietnam. You know, I always see those war movies where they have an outdoor theater or something like that, but
mm-hmm.
I don't remember anything of that nature.
Yeah.
On my way over to Vietnam, when they stopped in Tokyo, and I bought a 35 millimeter camera, and I took a lot of photographs, and one of the at the PX, they had a trailer there that had a dark room, and you could develop your own film, and they had a guy there that would instruct you on how to do it and everything, so I did that to pass time. I also wrote letters home,
mm-hmm.
so that was basically it, except for if you went on R&R, you know, you got a one-week R&R, and we also, there was a place called Camp Eagle that was along the beach that sometimes you would get a two-day pass to go down there, and it was a real nice beach resort, pretty well kept. They would have, like, it seemed like mostly Filipino bands that would come there to be live entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And, I believe I went there twice, I think. It was like a two-day pass.
Mm-hmm. How about radios?
You know what? I can't remember. Well, we had that was one of the channel selectors on the helicopter. We had Armed Forces Vietnam Network on there.
No,
that was the only
radio
station that was available. That was
What for recreational purposes when you weren't flying?
No, mostly stereos with select music, that type thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, when you were getting closer to leaving, did you, operationally, did anything change for you?
What happened was we were starting to, the 101st Airborne Division was standing down, so the Arvins were taking over, and then part of the thing with the stand down was we had to account for all the parts and tools and everything that we have, and when I had about a month left in country, the CO comes to me and says, look, you've been flying long enough, that's time for you to take a break, why don't you, and help me out with this, we got to account for all of our tools and all of our parts and stuff like that, so I spent, the last month in the supply room,
mm-hmm.
with another guy, inventory and everything.
Okay.
So, and they would do that with most of the air crews, with the pilots, when you got to like a month left in the country, they would try and cut down on that with your flight time.
Mm-hmm. And was there, in your attitude or your perception, was there, did it change at all from the time you got there to the time you left? You know, as far as the war itself? And how you felt about it?
Yeah, well, I guess, it changed from the TV version to the realistic version, you know, it was almost like that you know, when people got hurt or killed, they really got hurt or killed, you know. And then also, like I believe I mentioned earlier, it seemed like with the TV version, it seemed like war was more on a constant basis, whereas the Vietnam War, it seemed more like it was a small period of times that came and went fastly, you know, as far as like, you were getting shot at or something like that,
mm-hmm.
that nature.
Okay.
And I guess that was because of the job that I had. If you were on a helicopter and somebody was shooting at you, you could get out of the area, you know.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel when you left?
I felt a little bad for the people, you know, the GIs that were staying behind, you know, mm-hmm. thinking, oh my gosh, I hope they're going to be all right. I felt bad for the South Vietnamese people, because I felt like, you know, with the stand downs and everything, that we were kind of like deserting them. You know, we were pulling them out and leaving them on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, I really felt that, you know, but if anything should happen where they would really get in trouble, that America will come back. They will, just won't desert them like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They won't. You know, I figured, well, you know, they had negotiated somewhat of a truce, you know, where, and, you know, everything was going to be all right. And then when it did finally fall, when South Vietnam did fall, I felt real bad then. I thought we deserved it.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, these people, you know, they wanted to be free, you know, and they were counting on us, and we kind of let them down.
What was it like coming back to the United States for you? Why don't you go ahead and describe the flight over, where you came in, you know, what it was like. Was there anybody there at the airport, that kind of stuff?
Okay, well, the return to Vietnam, it was we flew I believe we stopped in Japan, refueled, and then flew right to Fort outside of Fort Lewis, Washington. I can't remember the Air Force base where we... no, actually, I think we landed at a civilian airport. And I got a tip on the on my way over there. They had, like, at Fort Lewis, Washington, they had a reception center for everybody that was coming back from Vietnam. They had, when you got there, they gave you a steak dinner and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to a couple of guys that were coming back, you know, asking, you know, quizzing them, hey, what was it like, and stuff like that. And the one guy said to me, he says, look, he says, if you want to do something smart, he says, take your dress uniform with you. I said, what? He says, I'll tell you to turn it in, but don't turn it in. He says, take it with you. And I said, why? He said, because when we landed in the airport, the guys that had the dress uniforms, they didn't have to come to Fort Lewis. All they did was go get their, since they had their dress uniform, they could go get their ticket to go home. And they went home. He said, we had to come here and get, they're giving us this meal, and then they're going to issue us our dress uniform, and it's all taking time. So I did that.
Mm.
So when I landed in, I guess it was SeaTac Airport, I was able to tell them that, hey, I got my dress uniform, and I went right to a civilian ticket counter and purchased my ticket to go home. And the flight was pretty quick. It was like within a couple hours.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew from there. I believe we stopped in Denver, Colorado, and then Chicago O'Hare, and then right to Philadelphia. When I got to Chicago O'Hare, I called home to tell them that, hey, 3 hours I'll be home. And my brother answered the phone and said, well, that my dad and my stepmother were out, and they probably wouldn't be back. He said, but we'll come over and pick you up. You know? So I believe it was my two brothers and sister were at the airport when I got there. And,
mm-hmm.
We got home, and I was sitting at the kitchen table when my dad came back from being out for the night. So the fact of that, when you're in Da Nang and you don't know when you're leaving until you know, you give a urine sample, you know, there's no chance for me to call and say, hey, I'm en route, you know, and I was hustle bustle, and so there was no way to let them know that I was coming until I had a little layover in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But as far as the rest of the people on the flight, they almost, with the military people, they almost like pretended like they weren't there. You weren't there. There was, you know, there wasn't any, like, hey, thanks a lot for serving your country or none of that. But they also, I didn't have anybody, you know, call me a baby killer or anything of that nature. Mm-hmm. There was the one stewardess that got on board, I guess, in Denver, and she made the flight all, no, it must have been, she got on board in Chicago and made the flight to Philadelphia, and she treated me pretty good. She was very friendly. I believe the flight included one complimentary drink. Well, she gave me as many drinks as I wanted. So she was, I thought that maybe she had somebody that was in the military the way she, you know, she treated me pretty good. And then, my, you know, my dad walked through the door, seen me, come over there, gave me a bear hug and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, family, friends, nobody asked, hey, what was it like? You know, nobody seemed to ask any questions. So, it was almost like taboo or whatever. I don't know. And, for the most part, went on with my life, and kind of like Vietnam was a thing that you forgot. And then I guess maybe 10 years after I returned, all of a sudden there were some books coming out, and I started doing some reading. And then I... you know, started. I worked at the mobile oil refinery and started. It was kind of funny because you're working with all these guys, and here some of them were Vietnam vets and never said anything, and then you find out, you know, 10 years later. And, in fact, it was kind of funny because one of the guys that I worked with there for 10 years, we were just happened talking about basic training, and he said that he had went to Fort Bragg and. We were there at the same time, and I asked him, I said, well, what a company were you in? And he said, EA2. I said, you kidding me? I was in the same company. And I immediately went home and pulled out some old orders, and here his name was McLeod, and here he was in the same basic training company that I was in. Uh-huh. And we worked together for 10 years and never knew it. You know?
Oh, that's funny.
And he was in a different platoon, but the same company. Uh-huh. And his recollection of the names of the drill sergeant and everything was a lot better than mine. I was surprised. You know, when, as soon as he said the name, I said, oh, yeah, I remember that guy. And then there was a couple other things that happened was one of the guys that was in the instrument department at where I worked, I didn't really know him that well. I knew him to see him. I knew him by name. Mm-hmm. And here they were telling me, oh, yeah, his brother was killed over in Vietnam, and he was in a helicopter. So I went over and I talked to him, and his name was Dave Dempsey, and his brother's name was Walt Dempsey. And here he was over in Vietnam the same time I was there, and he was with the 101st Airborne, but he was stationed down at Camp Eagle. And he had actually kept on re-enlisting, and then finally his helicopter was shot down and was killed. And Dave Dempsey was telling me, he says, I got these map coordinates for the site of where my brother was shot down, and but his body was, he was confirmed dead, but his body was never recovered. He says, and I got these map coordinates, he says, but every map I looked, none of them match. And I said, well, I got some aerial charts from when I was over there. I said, let me get them, and I brought them into work, and he had the map coordinates, and it matched the numbers that I had on my map, and we were able to pinpoint the location where he had went down, and it was right on the border between Laos and South Vietnam. So I said, no, well, maybe he got shot down over in Vietnam, and they gave the grid coordinates right on the border. Because what had happened was, this was during LANSAM 719 also, that they had sent a recon team out, and they had a new commanding officer. It was a lieutenant in squad.
Mm-hmm.
And when they inserted them, they started getting surrounded by North Vietnamese, and the lieutenant started getting scared, and they said that he called back and requested an extraction right away, that they were surrounded and they were closing in on them. So this Dempsey guy was the crew chief on it, and they went out, and they had a jungle penetrator, and they had pulled four guys on board, and one guy was still on the jungle penetrator when they started receiving some pretty nasty fire, and they started pulling out of there, and the guy that was on the jungle penetrator, what happened was right before the helicopters crashed, the crew chief had chopped the cable, and he fell into the trees, and he was the only survivor, and he walked out of the jungles, and they had sent a rescue team in the day, the next morning, because they knew where the crash site was, and they went down there and they put all the bodies in the body bag, except for Dempsey, because he was underneath the helicopter and they couldn't lift it. And then the North Vietnamese closed on the rescue team, and it was too foggy to pull them out, and they walked out, so they never recovered any of the bodies. So Dave Dempsey, the guy I knew, he actually, about 4 years ago, he went over to Vietnam and worked with the U.S. recovery team, and they went out actually into the, and the fellow that was on the jungle penetrator with him went with him, and they went into the Ashaw Valley, and they got some mountain yard scouts that took them to where they thought the crash site was, and they found it was a naval plane, because it had a hook on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were trying for another spot, and there was Vietnamese soldiers that were with them, and they got too close to the border, and they said, no, can't go. I guess he's saying that there's still some tension between the Laotians and the Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wasn't able to get to the crash site, but he had tried.
Okay.
And then there was another guy I worked with, his name was Mike Spina. His brother was killed over in Vietnam, and he said that, you know, the Marines never told him what happened or anything. And I said, well, let me see if I can do some research. So I wrote to the Marine Corps Record Division down there near Washington, D.C., and they sent me a whole bunch of information on it, and I was able to, they actually sent, like, the company journal, and I was able to tell him and show him on a map where his brother was killed and actually what happened. So, but it was strange. It was almost like there was like a 10-year period where nobody even wanted to talk about Vietnam. You know? And then all of a sudden people started talking about it.
Okay. Well, was it a difficult transition for you coming back to the United States from Vietnam?
No, it wasn't a difficult transition. I think the only thing that I thought that was kind of funny was I wasn't back that long, and I was riding in a car, and somebody in the car in front of me threw a cigarette out the window, and when the cigarette hit the street and it kind of exploded, I flinched, like, you know, and that was probably about the only thing that, you know, where I could say I was shell-shocked or anything that I can remember. I was anxious to, you know, move on with my life. I used the GI Bill to go to school, and, you know, it really, I hear stories about guys having a hard time transitioning, but to me it wasn't a problem. I was kind of young. I was only 19 at the time. Maybe mm-hmm. it was easier for me. I don't know.
Okay. What do you think was the most important thing you took away from your Vietnam experience?
I would say, let's see, the most important thing that I took away from it, I would say that that I would never want to see anybody to get hurt unnecessarily, I guess, and as a result of it, I've everywhere when I worked at the refinery where I work now, I've been involved in safety committees that that try and do my best to make sure that nobody gets hurt on the job site. And I guess that would be I would think that would be the biggest influence that Vietnam had on me, that nobody get hurt unnecessarily.
What do you think we should take away from that experience as a nation?
I think as a nation, I think that we should never do again what we did to the South Vietnamese people, abandon them like that. If we're going to get involved in something like South Vietnam, then if you're going to make a total commitment, don't do it half-heartedly. Don't go in there and say, okay, we'll help you defend your country, but we're not going to be the aggressor and go and after the person that's trying to hurt you, that we're just going to stand here. And then if you want to make the commitment to the end. Don't say at some point in time, okay, well, you had enough, we're out of here. And I think if you do make that kind of a commitment to an ally where you say, okay, we're going to come in and help you defend yourself, then you have to be aggressive. You have to go after your opponent. You can't just sit there and be a defensive type operation. You have to be aggressive and go. And I guess before the country should commit themselves to a war like that, I think they first have to get the support of the people. They can't just go in there and think that the support will follow. I think they have to get the support like they did in World War II, of that nature, where the whole country was behind the military and what they were doing. And I guess in the Persian Gulf War, you saw that too. And there wasn't no messing around. It was, went in there and did what they had to do and got it done. Chased them out of Kuwait, and had them surrender and negotiated a treaty. Unfortunately, they didn't follow up on that though. But they did liberate Kuwait. So I guess that would be the most important thing I think that the country should learn about the Vietnam War.
What do you think about U.S. relations and policies towards Vietnam today?
I think bygones should be bygones. I think it's kind of a difficult thing though, because I know that. They probably almost have to treat it like they're treating China. They'd have to get a little bit better with their with the way they treat their own people. There have to be more human rights, I think, than what they have there. It was a shame, as the result of the takeover of Saigon. There was millions of people that lost their lives as a result of it. All the boat people that were trying to escape South Vietnam that drowned in the seas, all the re-education camps, the killing fields in Cambodia, that's the type of government that's still in place over in Vietnam. I think it's not the type of government that we should be that friendly with, but if we can persuade them to have better human rights, and then I believe that we could establish normal relationships with the country of Vietnam.
Okay. And how do you feel about your service in Vietnam today?
Well, I'm very glad that I had the opportunity to do it. It was, to me, it was an experience of a lifetime. I grew up basically knowing that someday I would probably have to serve my country, so I feel that I did, my part of that obligation. I did serve in the military. Vietnam is probably the most beautiful country I ever visited. I've been to a couple other countries. I was to Thailand. I was to Ireland. Ireland's a beautiful country, but it's nothing like Vietnam. It's some of the sunsets over there were phenomenal. The lush green, it was beautiful. And then the camaraderie that we had amongst the air crews. I don't think that I've ever experienced anything like that since. So it was a good experience.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
No, not that I can think of, unless you can think of anything.
Not right now.
Okay.
All right. Well, let me go ahead and end this officially. Thank you very much. This will end the interview with David Hawes.
Okay.